Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Danse Macabre by Stephen King, performed by William DeFreeze. What's Scary? By Stephen King. All my life I've been going to see scary movies, beginning with 1950s black and white monster fests like The Black Scorpion and Earth vs. the Flying Saucers, where the alien invaders look very much like the prawns in District 9, and although much has changed in my life since the days when it cost a quarter to get in and the butter on the popcorn was real, I find myself asking the same three questions. First, why do so many so-called horror movies, even those with big budgets, maybe especially those with big budgets, not work? Second, why do genre fans, such as myself, so often go in with high hopes and come out feeling unsatisfied, and worse, unscared? Third, and most important, why is it that others, sometimes those most unheralded others, with teensy budgets and unknown untried actors, do work, surprising us with terror and amazement? Oh, and here's a bonus question. Why do I care? What part of me feels driven to see another remake of The Hills Have Eyes? Not very good. Or The Last House on the Left? Brilliant. I'm 63 and my hair is graying. Shouldn't I have left all this childish crap behind? Apparently not. Hell, I don't even want to. In Danse Macabre, a book I wrote almost 30 years ago, I argued that people, attracted to stories about monsters and mayhem, are essentially pretty healthy, if sometimes morbid. Critics of the book, and there were quite a few, responded predictably, "Yeah, sure, what else are you gonna say, that you're all a bunch of sick canines?" Well, we probably are. But we also have an overload of imagination. Sometimes a blessing, sometimes, especially when it's late at night and you still can't sleep, a curse. One of the accessories you get when the Bureau of Genetics supersizes you in the imagination department is more worries than the average Joe or Jill has to deal with. So while Ma and Pa are downstairs watching American Idol, chowing on Doritos and worrying that their favorite warbler may get voted off the show, their over-imaginative little sunny boy or baby girl is upstairs listening to Slipknot and wondering if Doritos give you cancer. The imaginative person has a clearer fix on the fact of his/her fragility. The imaginative person realizes that anything can go disastrously wrong at any time. The imaginative person doesn't believe that serial killers only happen to other people. He or she understands that guys like Henry are actually out there, and running into one is a lot more likely than winning $350 million in the Powerball lottery. And there are a lot of other serial killers out there. They have names like cancer, stroke, or meeting a vodka-fueled alcoholic traveling southbound in the northbound lane of the turnpike. Your lane, at 110 miles an hour, fantasizing that his crappy little Honda Accord is the Millennium Falcon. In a case like that, decapitation and instant death might be the best-case scenario. Worst case, you wind up a quadriplegic pissing into a bag on your hip for 25 years or so. And the person with the supersize me imagination knows it. I'd argue that people whose entertainment needs can be satisfied with American Idol on the old tubola, or a wild and crazy night out to watch the Corn Patch Players put on the Sound of Music, are afflicted with imaginative myopia. Those of us who feel more and see in darker spectrums may be sick puppies, but we're also lively puppies, brave puppies too, because we keep on trucking in the face of everything we know can go wrong. For us, horror movies are a safety valve. They are a kind of dreaming awake. And when a movie about ordinary people living ordinary lives skews off into some blood-soaked nightmare, we're able to let off the pressure that might otherwise build up until it blows us sky high like the boiler that explodes and tears apart the Overlook Hotel in The Shining. The book, I mean. In the movie, everything freezes solid. How dorky is that? We take refuge in make-believe terrors so the real ones don't overwhelm us, freezing us in place and making it impossible for us to function in our day-to-day lives. We go into the darkness of a movie theater hoping to dream badly, because the world of our normal lives looks ever so much better when the bad dream ends. If we keep this in mind, it becomes easier to understand why the good horror movies work, even if they do so, as is often the case, completely by accident, and why the hundreds of bad ones just don't. Expensive CGI effects, elaborate makeup jobs, and exploding blood bags won't scare anybody over the age of 14, 3 years younger than you have to be to get into an R-rated movie. The kids have seen it all before. It's boring. If a horror movie is going to work, there has to be something in it beyond splatter. Either by pure chance, Tobe Hooper's The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, or by pure genius, Sam Raimi, Steven Spielberg, some filmmakers are able to reach that something. They grope into our subconscious minds, find the things so terrible we can't even articulate them, unless you've got the money and the inclination to spend 20 years or so on a psychiatrist's couch, that is, and allow us to confront them. Not directly, though. Few of us are able to look straight into the eyes of the Gorgon. Humans deal better with symbols. The cross equals Christianity. The swastika equals Nazism. Or Nazism, if you're Brad Pitt in Inglorious Bastards. A number 3 decal on the back window of your pickup says you still miss Dale Earnhardt. That being the case, the central thesis of Danse Macabre, written all those years ago, still holds true. A good horror story is one that functions on a symbolic level, using fictional and sometimes supernatural events to help us understand our own deepest real fears. And notice I said understand and not face. I think a person who needs help facing his or her fears is a person who isn't strictly sane. If I assume most horror readers are like me, and I do, then we're as sane or saner than those who read People, their daily newspapers, and a few blogs, and then call themselves good to go. My friends, a vicarious obsession with celebrities and a few dearly held political opinions is not a useful life of the imagination. That's the life of a beetle that just happens to have opposable thumbs and the ability to count to 10. I'm sure a lot of the so-called realists who run the world think we're cracked, pervo, and possibly ready to shoot up the local high school when they see us paying for a magazine with a decomposing monster on the cover, but that's their problem. I don't know about you, but as far as I'm concerned, everything's cool with the kid. I'm all for make love, not war, as long as I can have Jason and Freddy. The American Idol folks can collect all the Care Bears they want. I like my fear bears. Besides, how can you not love a genre where a movie, The Blair Witch Project, made for under $100,000, can scare the bejabbers out of the whole world and gross a mind-boggling $250 million? That's either pure democracy or pure anarchy. Pick the term you like best. I think they're both beautiful. Here is a case where the low-budget and unknown acting troupe became integral parts of the film's success. There's nothing hyped up and phony about Blair Witch, the way all the Saw movies after the original and Saw 2 are hyped up and phony, the cinematic equivalent of Thanksgiving Day parade floats. One thing about Blair Witch, the damn thing looks real. Another thing about Blair Witch, the damn thing feels real. And because it does, it's like the worst nightmare you ever had. The one you woke from gasping and crying with relief because you thought you were buried alive and it turned out the cat jumped up on your bed and went to sleep on your chest. Horror, like comedy, looks easy. In one, you throw a pie in someone's face and roll the camera. In the other, you throw blood in the person's face and roll it. Gotta work, right? Actually, wrong. Horror's not a delicate genre. There's nothing delicate or refined about movies where people turn into bubbling goo when some extraterrestrial plague starts eating them alive. But it's mysterious. What works one time That final hand from the grave scare and carry, for instance, often won't work again, at least until it does. What worked in a super low-budget flick like Blair Witch may not work on a higher budget. The sequel, Book of Shadows, for instance. I loved it, but I was pretty much alone on that one. Making a successful horror movie is like catching lightning in a bottle, and even the most talented filmmakers may only be able to do it once or twice. When Sam Raimi finally returned to his roots with Drag Me to Hell, he created a movie that's terrific fun, but not particularly scary. If you want scary, you have to go back to The Evil Dead, or Curse of the Demon, the British film that inspired Hell, and even that may be a wasted trip by now. A good horror movie is in many ways like a good joke. Revisit the punchline too many times, and it wears out. When you've been around horror movies a while, you become aware that the same themes and bogeymen come up again and again, and the bogeymen often wear the same hockey masks. This is partly because we have a tendency to return to what scares us. In real life, we call this need obsessive-compulsive disorder. And partly because, hey, let's face it, horror is the home turf of cinematic quick-buck artists and con men. Studios and indie producers have a tendency to greenlight the same idea over and over again, running the money-pressing machinery until every last buck has been squeezed out of it. The squeezing results in clear cycles that fans of the genre have seen again and again. Genius gives birth to genius perfected. Genius perfected gives birth to unenlightened imitation. Think of any direct-to-video haunted house flick or made-for-TV demon kid movie that ever bored you to death. Unenlightened imitation gives birth to comedy, after which the basic idea lies still for a time before coming back to life again, like a vampire in his coffin. Here are three specific examples, beginning with The Blair Witch Project. The first time I saw Blair Witch was in a hospital room about 12 days after a careless driver in a minivan smashed the shit out of me on a country road. I was, in a manner of speaking, the perfect viewer, roaring with pain from top to bottom, high on painkillers and looking at a poorly copied bootleg videotape on a portable TV. How did I get the bootleg? Never mind how I got it. Around the time, the three would-be filmmakers, Heather Donahue, Joshua Leonard, and Michael Williams, who coincidentally happened to be played by Heather Donahue, Joshua Leonard, and Michael Williams, start discovering strange Lovecraftian symbols hanging from the trees, I asked my son, who was watching with me, to turn the damn thing off. It may be the only time in my life when I quit a horror movie in the middle because I was too scared to go on. Some of it was the jerky quality of the footage, shot with a Hi-8 handheld and a 60mm shoulder-mounted. Some of it was the dope, but basically I was just freaked out of my mind. Those didn't look like Hollywood location woods. They looked like an actual forest in which actual people could actually get lost. I thought then that Blair Witch was a work of troubling, accidental horror, and subsequent viewings, where I actually finished the film, haven't changed my mind. The situation is simplicity itself. The three kids, who start out making a documentary about a clearly bogus witch legend, get lost while making their movie. We know they are never going to get out. We're told on the title card, which opens the movie, that to date they have never been found. Only the jumpy, disconnected, haunting footage they shot remains. The idea is complete genius, and a big budget would have wrecked it. Shot on a shoestring, a ragged one, this docu-horror movie gained its punch not in spite of the fact that the actors hardly act at all, but because of it. We become increasingly terrified for these people. Even the annoying, over-controlling Heather, who never shuts up and continues to insist everything is totally okay, long after her two male companions and everybody in the audience knows it's not. Her final scene, an excruciating close-up where she takes responsibility as one tear lingers on the lashes of her right eye, packs a punch that few Hollywood films, even those made by great directors, can match. The fearless girl director, who confidently proclaimed, "I know exactly where we're going," has been replaced by a terrified woman on the brink of madness. And, sitting in a darkened tent after 6 nights in the woods, with the Hi-8 camcorder held up to her own face, we understand that she knows it. Blair Witch, it seems to me, is about madness. Because what is that really, except getting lost in the woods that exist even inside the sanest heads? The footage becomes increasingly jerky, the cuts weirder, the conversations increasingly disconnected from reality. As the movie nears the end of its short course, at just 80 minutes and change, is like a jury-rigged surface-to-surface missile loaded with dynamite, the video actually disappears for long stretches, just as rationality disappears from the mind of a man or a woman losing his/her grip on the real world. We are left with a mostly dark screen, panting elliptical lines of dialogue, some we can understand, some we can only guess at, noises from the woods that might or might not be made by human beings, and occasional blurry flashes of image, a tree trunk, a jutting branch, the side of a tent in a close-up so intense that the cloth looks like green skin. "Hungry, cold, and hunted," Heather whispers. "I'm scared to close my eyes, and I'm scared to open them." Watching her descent into irrationality, I felt the same. The movie climaxes when Heather and Michael find a decaying house deep in the woods. Shot almost completely in 16mm black and white at this point, the movie confronts us with a series of images that are simultaneously prosaic and almost too awful to bear. The wreckage inside seems to glare. Still carrying the camera, Heather bolts up the stairs. At this point, her two friends seem to be calling from everywhere, and the camera's randomly shifting eye flows past the handprints of the children who have almost certainly been murdered in this house. There's no dramatic music here or anywhere else. Blair Witch needs no such cinematic steroids. The only sounds are shuffling footsteps, yelling voices from everywhere, and Heather's escalating moans of terror. Finally, she plunges down to the basement, where one of the hokey stories they were told before their rash entry into the woods turns out not to be bullshit after all. Michael, or is it Josh, stands in the corner, dumbly waiting for the thing from the woods to do what it will. There is a thud as that unseen thing falls on Heather from behind. The camera drops, showing a blurred nothing. The film ends. And if you're like me, you watch the credits, trying to escape the terrified 10-year-old to whom you have been regressed. There have been fewer imitators of Blair Witch's documentary style than you might expect, given its absurd box office numbers. I believe that's because mainstream Hollywood moguls find something inherently offensive about amateurs playing with cameras, and they certainly don't want to look like amateurs themselves. In one Blair Witch sequence, you can hear a plane go droning overhead, and even though it works in the context of the film, I can't think of a single Hollywood producer who wouldn't tear his toupee off in the screening room when he heard it. Or how about the studio exec who wouldn't be able to restrain himself from saying, "These kids are nowhere. Can we replace them? Who's hot at Disney right now?" The mainstream faux docs I can think of, Cloverfield, Quarantine, the remake of The Spanish Wreck, Diary of the Dead, are all pretty good, but only George A. Romero's Diary approaches the purity of Blair Witch. Not until District 9 do we find genius perfected. It's not pure, if we take that to mean absolute adherence to the ideas of amateurs with cameras. And of course, D9 is not a pure horror movie either, but the technique allows the film to achieve a sense of reality that's seldom seen in the old monsters from space genre. With its use of mixed media, documentary footage, fake news reports, even what looks like home movies, District 9 is closer to Orson Welles' radio version of War of the Worlds than it is to an entertaining but ultimately disposable big-budget flick like Independence Day. Even the D9 mothership feels real. Instead of an awe-inspiring, almost heavenly apparition like the mothership in Close Encounters, this baby looks like a stalled-out tractor-trailer rig that the driver, probably drunk, left in a no-parking zone. D9 is nothing like Blair Witch in terms of its subtext. Neil Blomkamp's film is about xenophobia rather than madness, but I'd argue that without Blair Witch, D9 wouldn't exist, at least not in its current form. And before leaving Blair Witch, I want to recommend Daniel Myrick's most recent film, The Objective. It isn't as successful as Blair Witch, but it's remarkably ambitious and has the same creepy vibe. The comedy horror doc hasn't come along yet, but I'm confident there are at least three in development. In any case, enough with the pagan symbols and crumbling houses hidden deep in the woods. Let's talk zombies. They've been around in the movies for a long time. I Walked with a Zombie, great title, not so great flick, came out in 1943. Macumba Love, a panting engine of sexuality featuring the large and delectable breasts of June Wilkinson, shambled into double bill theaters in 1960. Getting warmer, but still no genius. Romero's Night of the Living Dead followed in 1968. It was a groundbreaking horror movie for sure. Fans can tell you to this day where they were when they realized that Barbara's brother Johnny really was coming to get her. But the true genius was Romero's follow-up, Dawn of the Dead, with its uniquely American situation. Survivors of the original plague trapped in a mall surrounded by the living dead. The all-American shopper's heaven becomes a glittering chrome and plastic hell. The consumers become the consumed. Released in 1979, around the time that mall multiplexes were becoming not just common but de rigueur, it was the perfect fright film at the perfect time, and one of the few unrated movies to succeed commercially. Genius perfected would be Zack Snyder's 2004 Dawn remake, which begins with one of the best opening sequences of a horror film ever made. Anna, the gifted actress and director Sarah Pauley, is relaxing in bed with her husband, Luis, when they are visited by the cute little skate girl who lives next door in their suburban Milwaukee development. When Luis goes to see what she wants, cute little skate girl tears his throat open, turning him into a zombie. And in the Snyder version, the zombies move fast. Romero never liked that part, but it works. Through a miracle of inspired editing, just when did she pick up those car keys, for instance? Anna is able to escape, first into a neighborhood that's become a slaughterhouse, and finally into the countryside, with a handy mall nearby. I'd argue that the most effective terror sequences are either the result of instinct or pure accident, rather than screenwriting or direction, and that's the case here. Pauley is a Canadian actress whose face was largely unknown to American audiences in 2004. Her main claim to fame was getting fired by Disney, after refusing to remove her peace sign necklace at an award ceremony when she was 12. You go with your bad self, Sarah. If we saw an actress like Julia Roberts or Charlize Theron as Anna, we'd know she's going to live. Because it's Pauley, we root for her to escape, but we're not sure she will. Those first 9 minutes are a sonata of anxiety. The opening action ends with Anna crashing her car against a tree, and once again witness the miracles that can be accomplished in the editing room. The car runs at the tree on the driver's side, but in the next shot, hits dead center. The credits, which follow, set to Johnny Cash's The Man Comes Around, are accompanied by documentary and faux documentary footage. There's that Blair Witch influence again. That's supposed to show us the onset of the zombie plague. But the first shot shows something entirely different. And it's here that Snyder shows us exactly what this inspired remake is about, and how well he knew what was driving our fear engines at that particular point in time. What we see in that brief black-and-white shot is what looks like 1,000 devout Muslim worshippers bowing toward Mecca in unison, an image of mass belief that most Americans found troubling. By 2004, only 3 years downriver from 9/11, rampant consumerism was the last thing on our minds. What haunted our nightmares was the idea of suicide bombers driven by an unforgiving and unthinking, most of us believed, ideology and religious fervor. You could beat 'em or burn 'em, but they'd just keep coming, the news reports assured us. They would keep on coming until either we were dead or they were. The only way to stop them was a bullet in the head. Remind you of anything? And don't accuse me of racism or religious prejudice either. We're not talking about political, religious, or intellectual concepts here. We're talking about terror. And that's exactly what Snyder's zombies are, it seems to me. Fast-moving terrorists who never quit. You can't debate with them. You can't parley with them. You can't even threaten their homes and families with reprisals. All you can do is shoot them and then steer clear of the twitchers. Remember that their bite is worse than fatal. Are they dead? One of the mall survivors asks Steve, the repulsive rich guy. His response? Dead-ish. Man, that's scary. Yet some of the terror in Dawn transcends subtext and goes straight to the id. The movie's most frightening moment has nothing to do with politics. One of the mall survivors, Kenneth, played by Ving Rhames, has been communicating with another survivor, Andy, played by Bruce Bond, who is stranded on a nearby roof. They flash chess moves at each other on restaurant erase boards and note zombies who resemble celebrities. Andy, a dead shot, then picks them off. After being bitten by a ghoul, the dying, or already dead, Andy flashes one final sign. Not words, but a jagged smear of blood. In that single 3-second shot, Snyder tells us all we need to know about the insatiate hunger that lives in the decaying interior of an undead brain. In the end, the survivors, those who haven't been killed by zombies or each other, set sail on the loathsome Steve's booze cruise boat, heading for an unnamed island where they hope to find safety. The final credits suggest that hope is probably vain. It's not a cheery conclusion, but it didn't hurt the movie's grosses. Dawn dethroned Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ at the box office, suggesting that John Lennon was wrong. Zombies, not the Beatles, turned out to be more popular than Jesus. And that ending probably reflected the audience's deepest underlying fear. How can you escape terrorists who don't care about dying? There's no need for us to list the dozens of imitations. Comedy follows imitation as day follows night. Shaun of the Dead, brilliant. Black Sheep, amiably absurd, but in the last analysis, not up to much. And Zombieland, which I haven't seen at this writing. That one looks hopeful. I mean, hey, Woody Harrelson playing a stench-killing gunslinger named Tallahassee, you gotta like that. But I have my doubts. Partly because it looks like a slam dunk. Mostly because I don't like seeing my beloved monsters dressed up in clown suits and made mock of. I like mine raw and mean and still bleeding. Which brings us to the best horror movie of the new century. Denis Iliadis's brilliant revisiting of The Last House on the Left. The engine driving this movie is the most powerful the genre has to offer. Fear of the homicidal other. There have been hundreds, perhaps even thousands of these in the long history of the fright film, and most have the same underlying premise. You meet the homicidal other either as karmic retribution for doing something wrong, think of Janet Leigh in Psycho, who never would have been showering at the Bates Motel if she hadn't embezzled a bunch of money from the Phoenix business where she worked, or, this is worse, because you just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. There are very few homicidal other sequels that I care for. Saw 2 is one of the few exceptions to the rule, because they trade on a moral ambiguity that makes me uneasy. In A Nightmare on Elm Street, Freddy Krueger is flat-out evil. No question about it. We hate him and fear him from the get-go, and why not? He's a pedophile, a murderer, and a disfigured psycho from beyond the grave. But 7 sequels later, he has become, grotesque but true, a kind of pal. By the time Freddy vs. Jason rolled around in 2003, we were no longer expected to root for the nominal good guys, teenagers without an ounce of fat on them. What we were rooting for, as the sequels plodded on and on, was a high body count. These sequels are basically snuff movies. I go hoping to see something new and rarely find it. You can argue for Rob Zombie's excellent reimagining of Halloween if you wish to refute the point, but I'd note that Zombie's take on Michael Myers, an inspired collaboration for sure, isn't a sequel, but a remake. Which brings us back to the Eliadas version of Last House, the best horror redux in modern times. The Collingwood family, Emma, John, and daughter Mary, are on vacation at their lake house, which is marked by an ominously inverted sign reading, Lake Ends in the Road. Mary, played with courage and grace by Sarah Paxton, borrows the family car to go to town and visit her friend Paige, Marcia McIsaac, who works in the local grocery store. While they're talking, a young man named Justin, Spencer Treat Clark, tries to buy a pack of cigarettes with a blood-stained $20 bill. When Paige won't sell to him, he has no ID, Justin offers to trade them some good pot, which is back at the motel where he's staying with his family. It's this chance meeting that leads to the terrible events that follow, but it's also where Eliadas begins to spring the film surprises. Clark, whom some of you may remember as Silent Ray in Mystic River, gives a nuanced performance as the son of a homicidal maniac, Krug, played by Garrett Dillahunt. We identify his disturbing thousand-yard stare as the look of a dangerous psycho, but it's actually the numbed-out shock of an abused child who is more his father's victim than his son. Mary and Paige are taken captive by Krug, Krug's girlfriend, Sadie, Ricky Lindholm, and his brother Francis, Aaron Paul, of Breaking Bad fame. After a botched escape attempt by the girls, Paige is stabbed to death, Mary is raped, Krug does it himself after Justin refuses his father's invitation to go first and be a man, and then shot as she tries to swim across the lake to the house where her parents are awaiting her return. It's in this house that Krug and his devil's band seek shelter from a sudden summer storm, a coincidence, but a believable one, since Mary has purposely directed them toward it. So the homicidal others are given lodging for the night by the kindly parents of the very girl they have violated. Justin, who has taken Mary's necklace, leaves it where he knows the parents will find it. At roughly the same time Emma Collingwood spots it curled around the base of a coffee cup, she and John hear an irregular banging sound coming from outside. It's Mary, badly wounded, but still alive. In the original, she's killed after being raped. She has dragged herself from the lake and crawled up onto the porch, and is pushing a rocking chair against the side of the house. What follows is a carnival of parental revenge. Mom half-drowns Francis in the kitchen sink, then stuffs his arm down the garbage disposal and turns it on. Sadie is shot to death in the bathroom. Krug has his head exploded in the microwave after the outraged surgeon father has paralyzed him from the neck down. This last touch is the film's only false move, partly because it's presented in a clumsy flashback as the family crosses the lake to safety, partly because it's the only place where Last House looks like just another horror movie, and partly because, damn it, you can't run a microwave with the door open! The 2009 Last House is the most brutal and uncompromising film to play American movie theater since Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, which didn't play many. The MPAA initially gave it an X rating, and it was finally released unrated. The murder of Paige and the rape of Mary in the woods are particularly excruciating, because there's a sense of filthy reality about these crimes that the depredations of Michael Myers and Jason Voorhees can't match. There's zero audience rooting going on for the bad guys here. When Mary finally loses the struggle to keep her plain cotton underwear on, and we know it's really going to happen, we are filled with rage and sorrow. And if there's an emotion more foreign to a Friday the 13th movie than sorrow, I don't know what it is. Our identification is all with the victim. These are bad people, and they deserve what's coming to them. What they do not deserve is a sequel where they become our buddies. The very effectiveness of some horror movies, the ones that show us the homicidal other with all his masks thrown aside, dooms them when they come before the critics. Owen Gleiberman of Entertainment Weekly, a magazine I write for on a tri-weekly basis, gave Last House an F rating. And this one, like Michael Haneke's jolting American remake of his German film Funny Games, took a predictably vigorous pasting. Only Roger Ebert seemed to partially get it, praising the performances. Dillahunt, he points out, isn't just acting scary, he creates a character. but neglecting to note that great performances rise from stories where the motivations are believable and the things that happen have an air of inevitability. The original 1972 Last House on the Left, written and directed by Wes Craven, is so bad it rises to the level of absurdity. Call it Abbott and Costello Meet the Rapists. The bad guys are cartoons. The glare lighting is early American pornography. Mary's mom, in this version named Estelle and played by Cynthia Carr, looks suspiciously like Loretta Lynn, and the cops are a couple of bumbling stereotypes out of a 1940s dead-end kids comedy. The chainsaw climax, set in what appears to be a pine-paneled rumpus room, it may belong to one of the producers, is hilarious. The soundtrack is a wonder. This may be the only movie about rape, murder, and kidnapping to be set to a cheerful ricky-ticky public domain soundtrack. There's even a kazoo, a musical instrument I do not associate with terror. The one positive thing you could say about the original is that Craven must have had an extremely steep learning curve, because he started his career deep in negative territory. The Iliadis version is to the original what a mature artist's painting is to the drawing of a child who shows some gleams of talent. From the opening shot, a dream glide through the nighttime woods, the cinematography of Sharon Meyer is a work of beauty and a study in contrasts. From Krug's brutal murder of the cops, who were transporting him to prison, we jump to a serene underwater world where Mary floats beneath a cloud of silver exhaled bubbles. There is a similar ballet, a more nerve-wracking one, in the kitchen of the Collingwood cottage as Mary's mother makes subtle enticing advances toward the odious Francis, trying to get him to let his guard down enough for her to use a butcher knife on him. The analogous scene in the 1972 version, where Mama attempts to bite off the bad guy's dingus, is just grotesque. Worse, it's funny. I maintain that if the recent Last House hadn't come trailing the baggage of its infamous predecessor, and if it had been a foreign film that came equipped with subtitles, it would have been a critical success on the level of Repulsion, Diabolique, or An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, the short film by Robert Enrico that was telecast on CBS as a Twilight Zone episode. To some degree, Last House suffered from its own refusal to compromise, and I think it also paid a price for all its infamous predecessors, not just the original source material. But there's something else, too. Horror movies produce nerve music rather than head music. Because most critics, Ebert has always been an exception, tend to be creatures of the head rather than the heart, they can be amused, in a patronizing sort of way, by fright flicks that are too outlandish to be taken seriously. But they have a tendency to react with anger and outrage to the ones that operate successfully in the deep fathoms of primal fear. Last House, like Hitchcock's great film about the homicidal other, does exactly that. And, like the Iliadis film, Psycho was originally greeted with a chorus of largely negative reviews. Sadly, not many scare and splatter films are worthy of even such light analysis as I've given those I've addressed in this essay, but that doesn't mean there aren't others that are worth viewing or reviewing. Here are some others that have worked for me over the last 15 years or so. From Dusk Till Dawn, Robert Rodriguez's furious horror action picture, starring George Clooney and Quentin Tarantino. Although it was released in the mid-90s, Clooney and Tarantino play 70s-style bad guys who find themselves hiding out in a strip club populated by vampires. Twilight looks pretty thin compared to this. Scream. A knowing, funny, frightening send-up of the slasher genre, featuring a psycho and an Edvard Munch scream mask. Written by Kevin Williamson, Scream alternates laughs with authentic scares. Especially notable for the When a Stranger Calls riff that opens the movie. Not Drew Barrymore's finest hour, but certainly her finest horror hour. Mimic, Guillermo del Toro's first American film, and a work of brilliance and complexity. It plays on our fear of dark places, environmental mutation, science out of control, and killer insects can look like people. Perversely believable, with great effects and great performances by Charles S. Dutton and Mira Sorvino. Event Horizon. Basically, a Lovecraftian terror tale in outer space with a creeping unknown vibe, done by the Brits. The plot's messy, but the visuals are stunning, and there's an authentic sense of horrors too great to comprehend, just beyond the eponymous, I always knew I'd eventually get to use that word, Event Horizon. Pi. Made on a shoestring by director Darren Aronofsky, this film about a theoretical mathematician descending into madness, he thinks he has found a 216-digit number that can somehow make him a fortune on the stock market, is a clear precursor of the Blair Witch Project. I left the theater not entirely sure of what I'd seen, but filled with feelings of deep unease. This one gets inside you. Bride of Chucky.
Nah, just kidding.
Deep Blue Sea. Directed by the ever-popular Rennie Harlan, who could probably turn Heidi into an action flick.
Give up the secret formula, or the goat dies.
This movie about genetically engineered sharks, you could say, isn't up to very much. Until, at the most unexpected point of the film, one of the Super Makos rears up and bites Samuel L. Jackson in half. Yes! I screamed out loud, and I treasure any horror movie that can make me do that. Stir of Echoes. Writer-director David Koepp should be declared a national treasure. His adaptation of Richard Matheson's 1958 novel is an unsettling exploration of what happens when an ordinary blue-collar guy, Kevin Bacon, starts to see ghosts, thanks to a hypnotic suggestion. Final Destination. I love all these movies, with their elaborate Rube Goldberg setups. It's like watching R-rated splatter versions of those old Roadrunner cartoons. But only the first is genuinely scary, with its grim insistence that you can't beat the Reaper. When your time is up, it's up. Jeepers Creepers. Victor Salva is a troubling erratic director with a troubling erratic history, including a conviction for sexual molestation of a child. But this tightly focused film about a brother and sister who run across a supernatural serial killer in northern Florida is relentlessly terrifying, playing as it does on our feelings of claustrophobia. The pipe scene is pure genius. If you haven't seen it, watch it. If you have, watch it again. But steer clear of the teenage spam on a bus sequel. It's for shit. The Mothman Prophecies. Richard Gere adds weight and unease to this story of a reporter trying to recover from the loss of his wife and trying to understand the strange drawings she made shortly before the tumor in her brain killed her. He is drawn to a West Virginia town where all sorts of strange phenomena have been reported, including sightings of an otherworldly being called the Mothman. Good, scary movies sometimes work on us like those ominous dreams from which we wake just before they can plunge us into full-out nightmares. Gere's character never actually meets the Mothman, which isn't such a bad thing. He, or it, is scarier in the shadows. This movie reminded me of Val Cat People Luton's best work. Eight-Legged Freaks. Not really so scary, but great fun. Giant spiders that run fast and kill everyone they can. The actors look like they're having as much fun as the audience. Probably should have been titled, It Came from the Drive-In. 28 Days Later. A furious and sometimes infuriating zombie film shot on digital video in Hey, Look at Me style by Denny Boyle, most notable for its opening sequences in an eerily deserted London after clueless animal rights activists have loosed a living dead-type plague on the world. In its documentary feel, we can again see the influence of the Blair Witch Project. Shaun of the Dead. I know it's a send-up, but this Simon Pegg Edgar Wright gigglefest has a few genuinely frightening moments. A few good gross-outs, too. The best sequence combines humor and horror in a pleasantly disgusting souffle as Sean fails to notice the zombie uprising that has begun to happen all around him. We see it, but poor Sean just keeps missing the guy who gets bitten while he's mowing the lawn, etc., etc. Red Lights, Feu Rouge. In this French import, an alcoholic husband, Jean-Pierre Darroussin, and his long-suffering wife, Carole Bouquet, have a fight and split up while driving back from the summer camp where they left their kids. What follows on a darkened country road is a kind of double horror movie, as fascinating to watch as Spielberg's Duel. Saw. You know about this, but watch it again, and you'll see that it also works as a really superior mystery story. The same is true of Saw 2. The Jacket. Adrien Brody is terrific. Those long-suffering eyes. In this story of a war veteran who becomes the subject of a mad doctor's experiments, he's locked in a morgue drawer and catapulted 15 years into the future. This movie has a remarkable chilly intensity and a sense of impending tragedy. Pan's Labyrinth. Ophelia's harsh reality, the Spanish Civil War, and her retreat into a fantasy world populated by fauns and monsters are perfectly blended in Del Toro's exceptional movie. Once you see it, you never forget the pale, eyeless creature, every kid's nightmare, that almost catches Ophelia and eats her before she's able to escape back, for a while anyway, into the real world. The Descent. If I were to pick another movie to analyze closely, it would be this remarkable story of six women who go on a caving expedition and encounter a race of subhumans who resemble Del Toro's Pale Man, now that I think about it. What gives the movie its resonance is how the women play against each other. Their very real resentments and secrets allow us to believe the monsters in a way that most horror movies do not. I never tire of saying this. In successful creep shows, it's not the effects and mostly not even the monsters that scare us. If we invest in the people, we invest in the movie and in our own essential decency. Snakes on a Plane. Just my opinion, but if you didn't love this movie, what the hell are you doing reading this? The Hitcher, 2007. Rutger Hauer in the original will never be topped. But this is that rarity, a reimagining that actually works. And Sean Bean is great in the role Hauer originated. Do we really need this film? No. But it's great to have it. And the existential theme of many great horror films, terrible things can happen to good people and at any time, has never been so clearly stated. 1408. John Cusack gives a bravura performance as a cynical debunker of the supernatural who discovers there really is an invisible world out there, one full of horrors beyond imagining. As a one-man depiction of madness, it stands alone, and Room 1408 in the fictional Dolphin Hotel is scarier than all the rooms of Stanley Kubrick's Overlook put together. In overlooking Cusack's performance, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences once more proved that great work is almost never rewarded, if it's done in a horror movie. Kathy Bates in Misery is the exception that proves the rule. The Mist. The ending will tear your heart out, but so will life in the end. Frank Darabont's vision of hell is completely uncompromising. If you want sweet, the Hollywood establishment will be pleased to serve you at the Cineplex, believe me, but if you want something that feels real, come here. Darabont could have made a higher budget film if he'd added a cheerful, "It's all okay, kiddies," ending, but he refused. His integrity and courage shine in every scene. Funny Games. Already discussed, but if you love the genre and haven't seen this, you should, for the simple reason that it turns the genre on its head. When things don't go according to the psycho bad guy's plans, one of them just, well, see for yourself. Suffice it to say that it outrages the rules of reality, and that's always a good thing. The Ruins. The Scott Smith scripted adaptation of his novel isn't quite as creepy as the book, but the sense of dismay and disquiet grows as the viewer begins to sense that no one's going to get away. With its cast of mostly unknowns, this would play well on a double Halloween bill with Snyder's Dawn remake. The Strangers. An orchestration of growing disquiet and horror as a young couple, Liv Tyler and Scott Speedman, are set upon by a trio of masked psychotics. It starts slowly and builds from unease to terror to horror. In the same class as Jeepers Creepers, but a little more existential. Why is this happening? Just because it is. Like cancer, stroke, or someone going the wrong way on the turnpike at 110 miles an hour. These may not be your favorites, because none of us have quite the same fear receptors. What I'm trying to say, and to show by example, is that cinematic horror is a potent art form, and there's a lot more going on under the surface than immediately meets the eye. Therein lies its many dark pleasures. And the next time your parents or your significant other asks you why you want to go and see that crap, tell them this: Stephen King sent me. He told me to look for the good ones because they're the ones that speak to what's good in the human heart. And, of course, to what isn't. Because those are the things you have to look out for. It's easy enough, perhaps too easy, to memorialize the dead. This book is for six great writers of the macabre who are still alive: Robert Bloch, Jorge Luis Borges, Ray Bradbury, Frank Belknap Long, Donald Wandry, Manly Wade Wellman. Enter, stranger, at your risk. Here there be tigers. What was the worst thing you've ever done? I won't tell you that, but I'll tell you the worst thing that ever happened to me. The most dreadful thing. Peter Straub, Ghost Story. Well, we'll really have a party, but we gotta post a guard outside. Eddie Cochran, Come On Everybody. Forenote. This book is in your hands as the result of a telephone call made to me in November of 1978. I was at that time teaching creative writing and a couple of literature courses at the University of Maine at Orono, and working in whatever spare time I could find on the final draft of a novel, Firestarter, which will have been published by now. The call was from Bill Thompson, who had edited my first five books, Carrie, Salem's Lot, The Shining, Night Shift, and The Stand, in the years 1974 through 1978. More important than that, Bill Thompson, then an editor at Doubleday, was the first person connected with the New York publishing establishment to read my earlier unpublished work with sympathetic interest. He was that all-important first contact that new writers wait and wish for, and so seldom find. Doubleday and I came to a parting of the ways following The Stand, and Bill also moved on. He became the senior editor at Everest House. Because we had become friends as well as colleagues over the years of our association, we stayed in touch, had the occasional lunch together, and the occasional drinking bout as well. The best one was maybe during the All-Star Baseball game in July of 1978, which we watched on a big-screen TV over innumerable beers in an Irish pub somewhere in New York. There was a sign over the back bar which advertised an early bird happy hour, 8 to 10 a.m., with all drinks priced at 50 cents. When I asked the barkeep what sort of clientele wandered in at 8:15 a.m. for a Rum Collins or a Gin Rickey, he fixed me with a baleful smile, wiped his hands on his apron, and said, "College boys, like you." But on this November night, not long after Halloween, Bill called me and said, "Why don't you do a book about the entire horror phenomenon as you see it? Books, movies, radio, TV, the whole thing. We'll do it together if you want." The concept intrigued and frightened me at the same time. Intrigued because I've been asked time and time again why I write that stuff, why people want to read it or go to the flicks to see it, the paradox seeming to be, why are people willing to pay good money to be made extremely uncomfortable? I had spoken to enough groups on the subject and written enough words on the subject, including a rather lengthy foreword to my collection of short stories, Night Shift, to make the idea of a final statement on the subject an attractive one. Forever after, I thought I could choke off the subject by saying, "If you want to know what I think about horror, there's this book I wrote on the subject. Read that. It's my final statement on the clockwork of the horror tale." It frightened me because I could see the work stretching out over years, decades, centuries. If one were to begin with Grendel and Grendel's mom and work up from there, even the Reader's Digest condensed book version would encompass four volumes. Bill's counter was that I should restrict myself to the last 30 years or so, with a few side trips to explore the roots of the genre. I told him I would think about it, and I did. I thought about it hard and long. I had never attempted a book-length nonfiction project, and the idea was intimidating. The thought of having to tell the truth was intimidating. Fiction, after all, is lies and more lies, which is why the Puritans could never really get behind it and go with the flow. In a work of fiction, if you get stuck, you can always just make something up or back up a few pages and change something around. With nonfiction, there's all that bothersome business of making sure your facts are straight, that the dates jibe, that the names are spelled right. And worst of all, it means being out front. A novelist, after all, is a hidden creature. Unlike the musician or the actor, he may pass on any street unremarked. His Punch and Judy creations strut across the stage, while he himself remains unseen. The writer of nonfiction is all too visible. Still, the idea had its attractions. I began to understand how the loonies who preach in Hyde Park, the nutters, as our British cousins called them, must feel as they drag their soapboxes into position and prepare to mount them. I thought of having pages and pages in which to ride all my hobby horses. "And to be paid for it!" he cried, rubbing his hands together and cackling madly. I thought of a lit class I would be teaching the following semester, titled Themes in Supernatural Literature. But most of all, I thought that here was an opportunity to talk about a genre I love, an opportunity few plain writers of popular fiction are ever offered. As for my Themes in Supernatural Literature course, on that November night Bill called, I was sitting at the kitchen table with a beer, trying to dope out a syllabus for it, and musing aloud to my wife that I was shortly going to be spending a lot of time in front of a lot of people talking about a subject in which I had previously only felt my way instinctively, like a blind man. Although many of the books and films discussed in the pages which follow are now taught routinely in colleges, I read the books, saw the films, and formed my conclusions pretty much on my own, with no texts or scholarly papers of any type to guide my thoughts. It seemed that very shortly I would get to see the true color of my thoughts for the first time. That may seem a strange phrase. Further along in this book, I have written my belief that no one is exactly sure of what they mean on any given subject until they have written their thoughts down. I similarly believe that we have very little understanding of what we have thought until we have submitted those thoughts to others who are at least as intelligent as ourselves. So, yeah, I was nervous at the prospect of stepping into that Barrows Hall classroom, and I spent too much of an otherwise lovely vacation in St. Thomas that year, agonizing over Stoker's use of humor in Dracula and the paranoia quotient of Jack Finney's Body Snatchers. In the days following Bill's call, I began to think more and more that if my series of talks, I don't quite have balls enough to call them lectures, on the horror supernatural gothic field seemed well received, by myself as well as by my students, then perhaps writing a book on the subject would complete the circle. Finally, I called Bill and told him I would try to write the book. And as you can see, I did. All this is by way of acknowledging Bill Thompson, who created the concept of this book. The idea was and is a good one. If you like the book which follows, thank Bill, who thought it up. If you don't, blame the author, who screwed it up. It is also an acknowledgment of those 100 EH90 students who listened patiently and sometimes forgivingly as I worked out my ideas. As a result of that class, many of these ideas cannot even be said to be my own, for they were modified during class discussions, challenged, and in many cases, changed. During that class, an English professor at the University of Maine, Burton Hatlin, came in to lecture one day on Stoker's Dracula, and you will find that his insightful thoughts on horror as a potent part of a myth pool in which we all bathe communally also form a part of this book's spine. So thanks, Bert. My agent, Kirby McCauley, a fantasy horror fan and unregenerate Minnesotan, also deserves thanks for reading this manuscript, pointing out errors of fact, arguing conclusions, and most of all for sitting up with me one fine drunk night in the UN Plaza Hotel in New York and helping me to make up the list of recommended horror films during the years 1950 through 1980, which forms Appendix 1 of this book. I owe Kirby for more than that, much more, but for now, that will have to do. I've also drawn upon a good many outside sources during the course of my work in Danse Macabre, and I've tried as conscientiously as I can to acknowledge these on a pay-as-you-go basis, but I must mention a few that were invaluable. Carlos Clarence's seminal work on the horror film, An Illustrated History of the Horror Film, the careful episode-by-episode rundown of The Twilight Zone in Starlog, the Science Fiction Encyclopedia, edited by Peter Nichols, which was particularly helpful in making sense, or trying to anyway, of the works of Harlan Ellison and of the TV program The Outer Limits, and countless other odd byways that I happened to wander down. Lastly, thanks are due to the writers, Ray Bradbury, Harlan Ellison, Richard Matheson, Jack Finney, Peter Straub, and Ann River Siddons, among them, who were kind enough to answer my letters of inquiry and to provide information about the genesis of the works discussed here. Their voices provide a dimension to this work which would otherwise be sadly lacking. I guess that's about it. Except I wouldn't want to leave you with any idea whatsoever that I believe what follows even approaches perfection. I suspect plenty of errors still remain in spite of careful combing. I can only hope that they are not too serious or too many. If you find such errors, I hope you'll write to me and point them out, so I can make corrections in any future editions. And, you know, I hope you have some fun with this book. Nosh and nibble at the corners, or read the mother straight through, but enjoy. That's what it's for, as much as any of the novels. Maybe there will be something here to make you think, or make you laugh, or just make you mad. Any of those reactions would please me. Boredom, however, would be a bummer. For me, writing this book has been both an exasperation and a deep pleasure, a duty on some days and a labor of love on others. As a result, I suppose you will find the course you are about to follow bumpy and uneven. I can only hope that you will also find, as I have, that the trip has not been without its compensations. Stephen King, Center Level, Maine. Forenote to the paperback edition. About 2 months after I had begun work on Danse Macabre, I told a West Coast friend of mine who also likes horror stories and horror movies what I was doing. I thought he'd be pleased. Instead, he fixed me with a look of absolute horror and told me I was crazy. "Why?" I asked him. "Buy me a beer and I'll tell you," he said. I bought him a beer. He drank half of it and hunched over the table toward me, looking earnest. "It's crazy because the fans will tear your ass to pieces," he said. "You'll get as many things wrong as you do right, and none of those guys will pat you on the head for what you got right. They'll just drive you nuts with the stuff you got wrong. Do you really think you're going to be able to find research material on the Texas Chainsaw Massacre? Where are you going to look? The New York Times? Don't make me laugh. But half the people you talk to will tell you one thing. The other half will tell you another. Good God, you could talk to Roger Corman about the people in the Roger Corman movies from the 50s, and he'd get most of it wrong, because he made most of those movies in 3 weeks. But tell you something else, too. Half the stuff you read will be wrong, because the people who love this genre are just like you and me. In a word, crazy. But, and your own memories will play you false. Give it up. You'll screw up the waterworks righteously, and the fans will chew your ass because that's why fans are fans. Give it up and write another novel. But first, buy me another beer." I bought him another beer, but I didn't give it up, as you can see. Remembering what he said, however, I included a cagey note in the first forenote, inviting fans to write to me and tell me what I'd gotten wrong. There weren't millions of replies, but my doomsaying friend wasn't entirely wrong. There were hundreds. Which brings me to Dennis Etchison. Dennis Etchison is another West Coast horror fan. He is of medium height, usually bearded and handsome in an anti-L.A. fashion that is relieving. He is also funny, gentle, and thoughtful. His reading in the field has been deep and wide. His experience of fright films, both high and low, is very wide, and his understanding is great. He is also one hell of a fiction writer. And if you have not read his volume of short stories, The Dark Country, you have missed one of the great volumes in our peculiar field. And no, it isn't covered in this book because it was issued after 1980. The stories are not just good, they are without exception exciting, and in some cases genuinely great, the way that Oliver Onion's The Beckoning Fair One is great. The hardcover was printed in a limited edition, but there will be a paperback soon, a Berkeley paperback, and I advise you to run, not walk, to your nearest Emporium der Book store and pick up a copy of it as soon as it's available. And no, I was not paid for the plug. It comes from the heart. Anyway, Kirby McCauley suggested Dennis would be the perfect guy to comb the errors out of Danse Macabre for the paperback edition. I asked Dennis if he would do it, and Dennis said he would. I shipped him my growing file of You Fucked Up letters that very day by Federal Express, and I think Dennis did me and everyone who cares about accuracy and even such a dark dungeon as the field of horror fiction proud. This edition is rather more accurate in a number of respects than the hardcover and Berkeley's trade paperback edition, and Dennis Etchison, assisted by a marching company of horror fans, is the reason why. I wanted you to know that, and I wanted to thank the man for tucking in my shirt and combing my hair for me. Ladies and gentlemen, Dennis Etchison. Give him a hand, would you? He sure as hell gave me one. Stephen King, June 1983. Chapter 1. October 4, 1957, and an invitation to dance. For me, the terror, the real terror, as opposed to whatever demons and boogies which might have been living in my own mind, began on an afternoon in October of 1957. I had just turned 10, and, as was only fitting, I was in a movie theater, the Stratford Theater in downtown Stratford, Connecticut. The movie that day was, and is, one of my all-time favorites, and the fact that it, rather than a Randolph Scott Western or a John Wayne war movie, was playing was also only fitting. The Saturday matinee on that day, when the real terror began, was Earth vs. the Flying Saucers, starring Hugh Marlowe, who at the time was perhaps best known for his role as Patricia Neal's jilted and rabidly xenophobic boyfriend in The Day the Earth Stood Still, a slightly older and altogether more rational science fiction movie. In The Day the Earth Stood Still, an alien named Klaatu, Michael Rennie in a bright white intergalactic leisure suit, lands on the Mall in Washington, D.C. in a flying saucer, which, when under power, glows like one of those plastic Jesuses they used to give out at vacation Bible school for memorizing Bible verses. Klaatu strides down the gangway and pauses there at the foot, the focus of every horrified eye and the muzzles of several hundred army guns. It is a moment of memorable tension, a moment that is sweet in retrospect, the sort of moment that makes people like me simple movie fans for life. Klaatu begins fooling with some sort of gadget. It looked kind of like a weed eater, as I recall, and a trigger-happy soldier boy promptly shoots him in the arm. It turns out, of course, that the gadget was a gift for the president. No death ray here, just a simple interstellar cure for cancer. That was in 1951. On that Saturday afternoon in Connecticut, some 6 years later, the folks in the flying saucers looked and acted a good deal less friendly. Far from the noble and rather sad good looks of Michael Rennie as Klaatu, the space people in Earth versus the flying saucers looked like old and extremely evil living trees, with their gnarled, shriveled bodies and their snarling old men's faces. Rather than bringing a cure for cancer to the president like any new ambassador bringing a token of his country's esteem, the saucer people in Earth versus the flying saucers bring death rays, destruction, and, ultimately, all-out war. All of this, most particularly the destruction of Washington, D.C., was rendered with marvelous reality by the special effects work of Ray Harryhausen, a fellow who used to go to the movies with a chum named Ray Bradbury when he was a kid. Klaatu comes to extend the hand of friendship and brotherhood. He offers the people of Earth membership in a kind of interstellar United Nations, always provided we can put our unfortunate habit of killing each other by the millions behind us. The Saucerians of Earth versus the Flying Saucers come only to conquer. The last armada of a dying planet, old and greedy, seeking not peace, but plunder. The day the Earth stood still is one of a select handful, the real science fiction movies. The ancient Saucerians of Earth versus the Flying Saucers are emissaries of a much more common breed of film, the horror show. No nonsense about, it was to be a gift for your president here. These folks simply descend upon Hugh Marlowe's Operation Skyhook at Cape Canaveral and begin kicking ass. It is in the space between these two philosophies that the terror was seated, I think. If there is a line of force between such neatly opposing ideas, then the terror almost certainly grew there. Because just as the saucers were mounting their attack on our nation's capital in the movie's final reel, everything just stopped. The screen went black. The theater was full of kids, but there was remarkably little disturbance. If you think back to the Saturday matinees of your misspent youth, you may recall that a bunch of kids at the movies has any number of ways of expressing its peak at the interruption of the film or its overdue commencement. Rhythmic clapping, that great childhood tribal chant of, "We want the show! We want the show! We want the show!" Candy boxes that fly at the screen, popcorn boxes that become bugles. If some kid has had a black cat firecracker in his pocket since the last 4th of July, he will take this opportunity to remove it, pass it around to his friends for their approval and admiration, and then light it and toss it over the balcony. None of these things happened on that October day. The film hadn't broken. The projector had simply been turned off. And then the house lights began to come up. A totally unheard-of occurrence. We sat there looking around, blinking in the light like moles. The manager walked into the middle of the stage and held his hands up, quite unnecessarily, for quiet. 6 years later, in 1963, I flashed on that moment when one Friday afternoon in November, the guy who drove us home from school told us that the president had been shot in Dallas. 2. If there is any truth or worth to the dance macabre, it is simply that novels, movies, TV and radio programs, even the comic books dealing with horror, always do their work on two levels. On top is the gross-out level, when Regan vomits in the priest's face or masturbates with a crucifix in The Exorcist, or when the raw-looking, terribly inside-out monster in John Frankenheimer's Prophecy crunches off a helicopter pilot's head like a Tootsie Pop. The gross-out can be done with varying degrees of artistic finesse, but it's always there. But on another, more potent level, the work of horror really is a dance, a moving rhythmic search. And what it's looking for is the place where you, the viewer or the reader, live at your most primitive level. The work of horror is not interested in the civilized furniture of our lives. Such a work dances through these rooms which we have fitted out one piece at a time, each piece expressing, we hope, our socially acceptable and pleasantly enlightened character. It is in search of another place, a room which may sometimes resemble the secret den of a Victorian gentleman, sometimes the torture chamber of the Spanish Inquisition, but perhaps, most frequently and most successfully, the simple and brutally plain hole of a Stone Age cave dweller. Is horror art? On this second level, the work of horror can be nothing else. It achieves the level of art simply because it is looking for something beyond art, something that predates art. It is looking for what I would call phobic pressure points. The good horror tale will dance its way to the center of your life and find the secret door to the room you believed no one but you knew of. As both Albert Camus and Billy Joel have pointed out, the stranger makes us nervous, but we love to try on his face in secret. Do spiders give you the horrors? Fine. We'll have spiders, as in Tarantula, The Incredible Shrinking Man, and Kingdom of the Spiders. What about rats? In James Herbert's novel of the same name, you can feel them crawl all over you and eat you alive. How about snakes? That shut-in feeling? Heights? Or whatever there is. Because books and movies are mass media, the field of horror has often been able to do better than even these personal fears over the last 30 years. During that period, and to a lesser degree in the 70 or so years preceding, the horror genre has often been able to find national phobic pressure points, and those books and films which have been the most successful almost always seem to play upon and express fears which exist across a wide spectrum of people. Such fears, which are often political, economic, and psychological, rather than supernatural, give the best work of horror a pleasing allegorical feel. And it's the one sort of allegory that most filmmakers seem at home with. Maybe because they know that if the shit starts getting too thick, they can always bring the monster shambling out of the darkness again. We're going back to Stratford in 1957 before much longer, but before we do, let me suggest that one of the films of the last 30 years to find a pressure point with great accuracy was Don Siegel's Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Further along, we'll discuss the novel, and Jack Finney, the author, will also have a few things to say, but for now, let's look briefly at the film. There is nothing really physically horrible in the Siegel version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. There is in the Philip Kaufman remake, though. There is a moment in that film which is repulsively horrible. It comes when Donald Sutherland uses a rake to smash in the face of a mostly formed pod. This person's face breaks in with sickening ease, like a rotted piece of fruit, and lets out an explosion of the most realistic stage blood that I have ever seen in a color film. When that moment came, I winced, clapped a hand over my mouth, and wondered how in the hell the movie had ever gotten its PG rating. No gnarled and evil star travelers here, no twisted mutated shape under the facade of normality. The pod people are just a little different, that's all. A little vague, a little messy. Although Finney never puts this fine a point on in his book, he certainly suggests that the most horrible thing about them is that they lack even the most common and easily attainable sense of aesthetics. Never mind, Finney suggests, that these usurping aliens from outer space can't appreciate La Traviata or Moby Dick or even a good Norman Rockwell cover on the Saturday Evening Post. That's bad enough, but my God, they don't mow their lawns or replace the pane of garage glass that got broken when the kid down the street batted a baseball through it. They don't repaint their houses when they get flaky. The roads leading into Santa Mira, we're told, are so full of potholes and washouts that pretty soon the salesman who serviced the town, who aerate its municipal lungs with the life-giving atmosphere of capitalism, you might say, will no longer bother to come. The gross-out level is one thing, but it is on that second level of horror that we often experience that low sense of anxiety which we call the creeps. Over the years, Invasion of the Body Snatchers has given a lot of people the creeps, and all sorts of high-flown ideas have been imputed to Siegel's film version. It was seen as an anti-McCarthy film until someone pointed out the fact that Don Siegel's political views could hardly be called leftish. Then people began seeing it as a better dead than red picture. Of the two ideas, I think that second one better fits the film that Siegel made, the picture that ends with Kevin McCarthy in the middle of a freeway screaming, "They're here already! You're next!" to cars which rush heedlessly by him. But in my heart, I don't really believe that Siegel was wearing a political hat at all when he made the movie. And you will see later that Jack Finney has never believed it either. I believe he was simply having fun, and that the undertones just happened. This doesn't invalidate the idea that there is an allegorical element in Invasion of the Body Snatchers. It is simply to suggest that sometimes these pressure points, these terminals of fear, are so deeply buried and yet so vital that we may tap them like artesian wells, saying one thing out loud while we express something else in a whisper. The Philip Kaufman version of Finney's novel is fun, although, to be fair, not quite as much fun as Siegel's, but that whisper has changed into something entirely different. the subtext of Kaufman's picture seems to satirize the whole "I'm okay, you're okay, so let's get in the hot tub and massage our precious consciousness" movement of the egocentric 70s, which is to suggest that although the uneasy dreams of the mass subconscious may change from decade to decade, the pipeline into that well of dreams remains constant and vital. This is the real danse macabre, I suspect. Those remarkable moments when the creator of a horror story is able to unite the conscious and subconscious mind with one potent idea. I believe it happened to a greater degree with the Siegel version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, but of course both Siegel and Kaufman were able to proceed courtesy of Jack Finney, who sank the original well. All of which brings us back, I think, to the Stratford Theater on a warm fall afternoon in 1957. 3. We sat there in our seats, like dummies, staring at the manager. He looked nervous and sallow, or perhaps that was only the footlights. We sat wondering what sort of catastrophe could have caused him to stop the movie just as it was reaching that apotheosis of all Saturday matinee shows, the good part. And the way his voice trembled when he spoke did not add to anyone's sense of well-being. "I want to tell you," he said in that trembly voice, "that the Russians have put a space satellite into orbit around the Earth. They call it Sputnik." This piece of intelligence was greeted by absolute tomb-like silence. We just sat there, a theater full of 1950s kids with crew cuts, swivel cuts, ponytails, ducktails, crinolines, chinos, jeans with cuffs, Captain Midnight rings. Kids who had just discovered Chuck Berry and Little Richard on New York's one black rhythm and blues station, which we could get at night, wavering in and out like a powerful jive language from a distant planet. We were the kids who grew up on Captain Video and Terry and the Pirates. We were the kids who had seen Combat Casey kick the teeth out of North Korean gooks without number in the comic books. We were the kids who saw Richard Carlson catch thousands of dirty commie spies in I Led Three Lives. We were the kids who had ponied up a quarter apiece to watch Hugh Marlowe in Earth vs. the Flying Saucers, and got this piece of upsetting news as a kind of nasty bonus. I remember this very clearly. Cutting through that awful dead silence came one shrill voice, whether that of a boy or a girl, I do not know, a voice that was near tears, but that was also full of a frightening anger. "Oh, go show the movie, you liar!" The manager did not even look toward the place from which that voice had come. And that was somehow the worst thing of all. Somehow that proved it. The Russians had beaten us into space. Somewhere over our heads, beeping triumphantly, was an electronic ball which had been launched and constructed behind the Iron Curtain. Neither Captain Midnight nor Richard Carlson, who also starred in Riders to the Stars, and oh boy, the bitter irony in that, had been able to stop it. It was up there, and they called it Sputnik. The manager stood there for a moment longer, looking out at us, as if he wished he had something else to say, but could not think what it might be. Then he walked off, and pretty soon the movie started up again. 4. So here's a question. You remember where you were when President Kennedy was assassinated? You remember where you were when you heard that RFK had taken a dive in some hotel kitchen as the result of another crazy? Maybe you even remember where you were during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Do you remember where you were when the Russians launched Sputnik 1? Terror, what Hunter Thompson calls fear and loathing, often arises from a pervasive sense of disestablishment, that things are in the unmaking. If that sense of unmaking is sudden and seems personal, if it hits you around the heart, then it lodges in the memory as a complete set. Just the fact that almost everyone remembers where he/she was at the instant he/she heard the news of the Kennedy assassination is something I find almost as interesting as the fact that one nerd with a mail-order gun was able to change the entire course of world history in just 14 seconds or so. That moment of knowledge and the 3-day spasm of stunned grief which followed it is perhaps the closest any people in history has ever come to a total period of mass consciousness and mass empathy and, in retrospect, mass memory. 200 million people in a living freeze. Love cannot achieve that sort of across-the-board hammer strike of emotion, apparently. More's the pity. I'm not suggesting that the news of Sputnik's launching had anywhere near the same sort of effect on the American psyche, although it was not without effect. See, for instance, Tom Wolfe's amusing narrative of events following the successful Russian launch in his superlative book about our space program, The Right Stuff. But I am guessing that a great many kids, the war babies we were called, remember the event as well as I do. We were fertile ground for the seeds of terror. We war babies. We had been raised in a strange circus atmosphere of paranoia, patriotism, and national hubris. We were told that we were the greatest nation on earth, and that any Iron Curtain outlaw who tried to draw down on us in that great saloon of international politics would discover who the fastest gun in the West was. As in Pat Frank's illuminating novel of the period, Alas, Babylon. But we were also told exactly what to keep in our fallout shelters, and how long we would have to stay in there after we won the war. We had more to eat than any nation in the history of the world, but there were traces of strontium 90 in our milk from nuclear testing. We were the children of the men and women who won what Duke Wayne used to call the Big One, and when the dust cleared, America was on top. We had replaced England as the colossus that stood astride the world. When the folks got together again to make me and millions of kids like me, London had been bombed almost flat. The sun was setting every 12 hours or so on the British Empire, and Russia had been bled nearly white in its war against the Nazis. During the siege of Stalingrad, Russian soldiers had been reduced to dining on their dead comrades. But not a single bomb had fallen on New York, and America had the lightest casualty rate of any major power involved in the war. Further, we had a great history to draw upon. All short histories are great histories, particularly in matters of invention and innovation. Every grade school teacher produced the same 2 words for the delectation of his/her students, 2 magic words glittering and glowing like a beautiful neon sign, 2 words of almost incredible power and grace. And these words were, pioneer spirit. I and my fellow kids grew up secure in this knowledge of America's pioneer spirit, a knowledge that could be summed up in a litany of names learned by rote in the classroom. Eli Whitney, Samuel Morse, Alexander Graham Bell, Henry Ford, Robert Goddard, Wilbur and Orville Wright, Robert Oppenheimer. These men, ladies and gentlemen, all had one great thing in common. They were all Americans, simply bursting with pioneer spirit. We were, and always had been, in that pungent American phrase, fustest and bestest with the mostest. And what a world stretched ahead. It was all outlined in the stories of Robert A. Heinlein, Lester Del Rey, Alfred Bester, Stanley Weinbaum, and dozens of others. These dreams came in the last of the science fiction pulp magazines, which were shrinking and dying by that October in 1957, but science fiction itself had never been in better shape. Space would be more than conquered, these writers told us. It would be pioneered. Silver needles piercing the void, followed by flaming rockets, lowering huge ships onto alien worlds, followed by hardy colonies full of men and women, American men and women, need one add, with pioneer spirit bursting from every pore. Mars would become our backyard. The new gold rush, or possibly the new rhodium rush, might well be in the asteroid belt. And ultimately, of course, the stars themselves would be ours. A glorious future awaited with tourists snapping Kodak prints of the 6 moons of Procyon 4 and a Chevrolet jet car assembly line on Sirius 3. Earth itself would be transformed into a utopia that you could see on the cover of any 50s issue of Fantasy and Science Fiction, Amazing Stories, Galaxy, or Astounding Science Fiction. A future filled with the pioneer spirit. Even better, a future filled with the American pioneer spirit. See, for example, the cover of the original Bantam paperback edition of Ray Bradbury's Martian Chronicles. In this artistic vision, a figment of the artist's imagination and not of Bradbury's, there is nothing so ethnocentric or downright silly in this classic melding of science fiction and fantasy. The landing space travelers look a great deal like gyrenes storming up the beach at Saipan or Tarawa. It's a rocket instead of an LST in the background, true, but their jut-jawed automatic brandishing commander might have stepped right out of a John Wayne movie.
Come on, you suckers, do you want to live forever? Where's your pioneer spirit?
This was the cradle of elementary political theory and technological dream work in which I and a great many other war babies were rocked until that day in October when the cradle was rudely upended and all of us fell out. For me, it was the end of the sweet dream and the beginning of the nightmare. The children grasped the implication of what the Russians had done as well and as quickly as anyone else, certainly as fast as the politicians who were falling all over themselves to cut the good lumber out of this nasty deadfall. The big bombers that had smashed Berlin and Hamburg in World War II were even then, in 1957, becoming obsolete. A new and ominous abbreviation had come into the working vocabulary of terror, ICBM. The ICBMs, we understood, were only the German V-rockets, grown up. They would carry enormous payloads of nuclear death and destruction, and if the Ruskies tried anything funny, we would simply blow them right off the face of the earth. Watch out, Moscow, here comes a big hot dose of pioneer spirit for you, you turkeys. Except that somehow, incredibly, the Russians were looking pretty good in the old ICBM department themselves. After all, ICBMs were only big rockets, and the commies certainly hadn't lofted Sputnik 1 into orbit with a potato masher. And in that context, the movie began again in Stratford, with the ominous, warbling voices of the Saucerians echoing everywhere. Look to your skies! A warning will come from your skies! Look to your skies! 5. This book is intended to be an informal overview of where the horror genre has been over the last 30 years, and not an autobiography of yours truly. The autobiography of a father, writer, and ex-high school teacher would make dull reading indeed. I am a writer by trade, which means that the most interesting things that have happened to me have happened in my dreams. But because I am a horror novelist, and also a child of my times, and because I believe that horror does not horrify unless the reader or viewer has been personally touched, you will find the autobiographical element constantly creeping in. Horror in real life is an emotion that one grapples with, as I grappled with the realization that the Russians had beaten us into space, all alone. It is a combat waged in the secret recesses of the heart. I believe that we are all ultimately alone, and that any deep and lasting human contact is nothing more nor less than a necessary illusion. But at least the feelings which we think of as positive and constructive are a reaching out, an effort to make contact and establish some sort of communication. Feelings of love and kindness, the ability to care and empathize, are all we know of the light. They are efforts to link and integrate. They are the emotions which bring us together, if not in fact, then at least in a comforting illusion that makes the burden of mortality a little easier to bear. Horror, terror, fear, panic. These are the emotions which drive wedges between us, split us off from the crowd, and make us alone. It is paradoxical that feelings and emotions we associate with the mob instinct should do this, but crowds are lonely places to be, we're told, a fellowship with no love in it. The melodies of the horror tale are simple and repetitive, and they are melodies of disestablishment and disintegration. But another paradox is that the ritual outletting of these emotions seems to bring things back to a more stable and constructive state again. Ask any psychiatrist what his patient is doing when he lies there on the couch and talks about what keeps him awake and what he sees in his dreams. What do you see when you turn out the light? The Beatles asked. Their answer? I can't tell you, but I know that it's mine. The genre we're talking about, whether it be in terms of books, film, or TV, is really all one: make-believe horrors. And one of the questions that frequently comes up, asked by people who have grasped the paradox, but perhaps not fully articulated it in their own minds, is, why do you want to make up horrible things when there is so much real horror in the world? The answer seems to be that we make up horrors to help us cope with the real ones. With the endless inventiveness of humankind, we grasp the very elements which are so divisive and destructive, and try to turn them into tools to dismantle themselves. The term catharsis is as old as Greek drama, and it has been used rather too glibly by some practitioners in my field to justify what they do, but it still has its limited uses here. The dream of horror is in itself an outletting and a lancing, and it may well be that the mass media dream of horror can sometimes become a nationwide analyst's couch. So, for the final time before we push on, October of 1957. Now, absurd as it looks on the face of it, Earth versus the flying saucers has become a symbolic political statement. Below its pulpy invaders from space storyline, it becomes a preview of the ultimate war. Those greedy, twisted old monsters piloting the saucers are really the Russians. The destruction of the Washington Monument, the Capitol Dome, and the Supreme Court, all rendered with graphic, eerie believability by Harryhausen's stop-motion effects, becomes nothing less than the destruction one would logically expect when the A-bombs finally fly. And then the end of the movie comes. The last saucer has been shot down by Hugh Marlowe's secret weapon, an ultrasonic gun that interrupts the electromagnetic drive of the flying saucers, or some sort of similar agreeable foolishness. Loudspeakers blare from every Washington street corner, seemingly. The present danger is over. The present danger is over. The present danger is over. The camera shows us clear skies. The evil old monsters with their frozen snarls and their twisted root faces have been vanquished. We cut to a California beach, magically deserted, except for Hugh Marlowe and his new wife, who is, of course, the daughter of the crusty old military man who died for his country. They are on their honeymoon.
Russ, she asks him, will they ever come back?
Marlowe looks sagely up at the sky, then back at his wife. Not on such a pretty day, he says comfortingly. And not to such a nice world. They run hand in hand into the surf, and the end credits roll. For a moment, just for a moment, the paradoxical trick has worked. We have taken horror in hand and used it to destroy itself, a trick akin to pulling oneself up by one's own bootstraps. For a little while, the deeper fear, the reality of the Russian Sputnik and what it means, has been excised. It will grow back again, but that is for later. For now, the worst has been faced, and it wasn't so bad after all. There was that magic moment of reintegration and safety at the end, that same feeling that comes when the roller coaster stops at the end of its run and you get off with your best girl, both of you whole and unhurt. I believe it's this feeling of reintegration, arising from a field specializing in death, fear, and monstrosity, that makes the Danse Macabre so rewarding and magical. That, and the boundless ability of the human imagination to create endless dream worlds and then put them to work, it is a world which a fine poet, such as Anne Sexton, was able to use to write herself sane. From her poems expressing and delineating her descent into the maelstrom of insanity, her own ability to cope with the world eventually returned, at least for a while, and perhaps others have been able to use her poems in their turn. This is not to suggest that writing must be justified on the basis of its usefulness. To simply delight the reader is enough, isn't it? This is a world I've lived in of my own choosing since I was a kid, since long before the Stratford Theater and Sputnik 1.
I am certainly not trying to tell you that the Russians traumatized me into an interest in horror fiction, but am simply pointing out that instant when I began to sense a useful connection between the world of fantasy and that of what my weekly reader used to call current events. This book is only my ramble through that world, through all the worlds of fantasy and horror that have delighted and terrified me. It comes with very little plan or order, and if you are sometimes reminded of a hunting dog with a substandard nose casting back and forth and following any trace of interesting scent it happens to come across, that is fine with me. But it's not a hunt. It's a dance. And sometimes they turn off the lights in this ballroom. But we'll dance anyway, you and I, even in the dark. Especially in the dark. May I have the pleasure? Chapter 2. Tales of the Hook. The dividing line between fantasy and science fiction, for properly speaking, fantasy is what it is, the horror genre is only a subset of the larger genre, is a subject that comes up at some point at almost every fantasy or science fiction convention held, and for those of you unaware of the subculture, there are literally hundreds each year. If I had a nickel for every letter printed on the fantasy SF dichotomy in the columns of the amateur magazines and the prozines of both fields, I could buy the island of Bermuda. It's a trap, this matter of definition, and I can't think of a more boring academic subject. Like endless discussions of breath units in modern poetry or the possible intrusiveness of some punctuation in the short story, it is really a discussion of how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, not really interesting unless those involved in the discussion are drunk or graduate students. Two states of roughly similar incompetence. I'll content myself with stating the obvious inarguables. Both are works of the imagination, and both try to create worlds which do not exist, cannot exist, or do not exist yet. There is a difference, of course, but you can draw your own borderline, if you want. And if you try, you may find that it's a very squiggly border indeed. Alien, for instance, is a horror movie, even though it is more firmly grounded in scientific projection than Star Wars. Star Wars is a science fiction film, although we must recognize the fact that it's SF of the E.E. Doc Smith Murray Leinster whack-and-slash school, an outer space western just overflowing with pioneer spirit. Somewhere in between these two, in a buffer zone that has been little used by the movies, are works that seem to combine science fiction and fantasy in a non-threatening way. Close Encounters of the Third Kind, for instance. With such a number of divisions, and any dedicated science fiction or fantasy fan could offer a dozen more, ranging from utopian fiction, negative utopian fiction, sword and sorcery, heroic fantasy, future history, and on into the sunset, you can see why I don't want to open this particular door any wider than I have to. Let me, instead of defining, offer a couple of examples, and then we'll move along. And what better example than Donovan's Brain? Horror fiction doesn't necessarily have to be non-scientific. Kurt Siodmak's novel Donovan's Brain moves from a scientific basis to outright horror, as did Alien. It was adapted 3 times for the screen, and all versions enjoyed fair popular success. Both the novel and the films focus on a scientist who, if not quite mad, is certainly operating at the far borders of rationality. Thus, we can place him in a direct line of descent from the original Mad Lab's proprietor, Victor Frankenstein. And on back to Faust, Daedalus, Prometheus, Pandora, a genealogy leading straight back into the mouth of hell if ever there was one. This scientist has been experimenting with a technique designed to keep the brain alive after the body has died, specifically in a tank filled with an electrically charged saline solution. In the course of the novel, the private plane of W.D. Donovan, a rich and domineering millionaire, crashes near the scientist's desert lab. Recognizing the knock of opportunity, the scientist removes the dying millionaire's skull and pops Donovan's brain into his tank. So far, so good. This story has elements of both horror and science fiction. At this point, it could go either way. depending on Syed-Mack's handling of the subject. One of the earlier versions of the film tips its hand almost at once. The removal operation takes place in a howling thunderstorm, and the scientist's Arizona laboratory looks more like Baskerville Hall. And none of the films is up to the tale of mounting terror Syed-Mack tells in his careful, rational prose. The operation is a success. The brain is alive, and possibly even thinking in its tank of cloudy liquid. The problem now becomes one of communication. The scientist begins trying to contact the brain by means of telepathy, and finally succeeds. In a half-trance, he writes the name W.D. Donovan 3 or 4 times on a scrap of paper, and comparison shows that his signature is interchangeable with that of the millionaire. In its tank, Donovan's brain begins to change and mutate. It grows stronger, more able to dominate our young hero. He begins to do Donovan's bidding, said bidding all revolving around Donovan's psychopathic determination to make sure the right person inherits his fortune. The scientist begins to experience the frailties of Donovan's physical body, now moldering in an unmarked grave, low back pain, a decided limp. As the story builds to his climax, Donovan tries to use the scientist to run down a little girl who stands in the way of his implacable, monstrous will. In one of its film incarnations, the beautiful young wife, no comparable creature exists in Syed-Mack's novel, rigs up lightning rods, which zap the brain in its tank. At the end of the book, the scientist attacks the tank with an axe, resisting the endless undertow of Donovan's will by reciting a simple yet haunting mnemonic phrase. He thrusts his fists against the posts and still insists he sees the ghosts. The glass shatters, the saline solution pours out, and the loathsome pulsing brain is left to die like a slug on the laboratory floor. Syed-Mack is a fine thinker and an okay writer. The flow of his speculative ideas in Donovan's brain is as exciting to follow as the flow of ideas in a novel by Isaac Asimov or Arthur C. Clarke, or my personal favorite in the field, the late John Wyndham. But none of those esteemed gentlemen has ever written a novel quite like Donovan's brain. In fact, no one has. The final tip-off comes at the very end of the book, when Donovan's nephew, or perhaps it was his bastard son, I'll be damned if I can remember which, is hanged for murder. You can see why Donovan liked the kid enough to want to leave him his money, I think. Just a chip off the old block. 3 times the scaffold's trap door refuses to open when the switch is thrown, and the narrator speculates that Donovan's spirit still remains, indomitable, implacable, and hungry. For all its scientific trappings, Donovan's brain is as much a horror story as M.R. James's Casting the Runes, or H.P. Lovecraft's nominal science fiction tale, The Color Out of Space. Now, let's take another story. This one an oral tale of the sort that never has to be written down. It is simply passed mouth to mouth, usually around Boy Scout or Girl Scout campfires after the sun has gone down and marshmallows have been poked onto green sticks to roast above the coals. You've heard it, I guess. But instead of summarizing it, I'd like to tell it as I originally heard it, gape-mouthed with terror, as the sun went down behind the vacant lot in Stratford where we used to play scratch baseball when there were enough guys around to make up 2 teams. Here is the most basic horror story I know. This guy and his girl go out on a date, you know, and they go parking up on Lover's Lane. So anyway, while they're driving up there, the radio breaks in with this bulletin. The guy says this dangerous homicidal maniac named The Hook has just escaped from the Sunnydale Asylum for the criminally insane. They call him The Hook because that's what he's got instead of a right hand. This razor-sharp hook. And he used to hang around these Lover's Lanes, you know, and he'd catch these people making out and cut their heads off with the hook. He could do that because it was so sharp, you know. And when they caught him, they found like 15 or 20 heads in his refrigerator. So the news guy says to be on the lookout for any guy with a hook instead of a hand and to stay away from any dark, lonely spots where people go to, you know, get it on. So the girl says, "Let's go home, okay?" And the guy, he's this real big guy, you know, with muscles on his muscles. He says, "I'm not scared of that guy. He's probably miles from here anyway." So she goes, "Come on, Louie, I'm scared. Sunnydale Asylum isn't that far from here. Let's go back to my house. I'll make popcorn and we can watch TV." But the guy won't listen to her. Pretty soon they're up on the Outlook, parked at the end of the road, making out like banditos. But she keeps saying she wants to go home because they're the only car there, you know. That stuff about the hook scared away everybody else. But he keeps saying, "Come on, don't be such a chicken. There's nothing to be afraid of, and if there was, I'd protect you." Stuff like that. So they keep making out for a while, and then she hears a noise, like a breaking branch or something. Like someone is out there in the woods, creeping up on them. So then she gets real upset, hysterical, crying everything, like girls do. She's begging the guy to take her home. The guy keeps saying he doesn't hear anything at all, but she looks up in the rearview mirror and thinks she sees someone all hunkered down at the back of the car, just peeking in at them and grinning. She says if he doesn't take her home, she's never going to go out parking with him again and all that happy crappy. So finally he starts up the car and really peels out because he's so jacked off at her. In fact, he just about cracks them up. So anyway, they get home, you know, and the guy goes around to open her door for her. And when he gets there, he just stands there, turning as white as a sheet. And his eyes are getting so big, you'd think they was going to fall out on his shoes. She says, "Louie, what's wrong?" And he just faints dead away right there on the sidewalk. She gets out to see what's wrong. And when she slams the car door, she hears this funny clinking sound and turns around to see what it is. And there, hanging from the door handle, is this razor-sharp hook.
The story of The Hook is a simple, brutal classic of horror. It offers no characterization, no theme, no particular artifice. It does not aspire to symbolic beauty or try to summarize the times, the mind, or the human spirit. To find these things, we must go to literature, perhaps to Flannery O'Connor's story, A Good Man is Hard to Find, which is very much like the story of The Hook in its plot and construction. No, the story of The Hook exists for one reason and one reason alone, to scare the shit out of little kids after the sun goes down. One could jigger the story of The Hook to make him, it, a creature from outer space. And you could attribute this creature's ability to travel across the parsecs to a photon drive or a warp drive. You could make it a creature from an alternate Earth, a la Clifford D.C. Mac. But none of these SF conventions would turn the story of The Hook into science fiction. It's a flesh crawler pure and simple. And in its direct point-to-point progress, its brevity, and its use of story only as a means to get to the effect in the last sentence, it is remarkably similar to John Carpenter's Halloween. "It was the bogeyman," Jamie Lee Curtis says at the end of that film. "As a matter of fact," Donald Pleasance agrees softly, "it was. Or the fog." Both of these movies are extremely frightening, but the story of The Hook was there first. The point seems to be that horror simply is, exclusive of definition or rationalization. In a Newsweek cover story titled Hollywood's Scary Summer, referring to the summer of 1979, the summer of Phantasm, Prophecy, Dawn of the Dead, Nightwing, and Alien, the writer said that during Alien's big scary scenes, the audience seemed more apt to moan with revulsion than to scream with terror. The truth of this can't be argued. It's bad enough to see a gelatinous crab thing spread over some fellow's face, but the infamous chestburster scene which follows is a quantum leap and grew. And it happens at the dinner table yet. It's enough to put you off your popcorn. The closest I want to come to definition or rationalization is to suggest that the genre exists on three more or less separate levels, each one a little less fine than the one before it. The finest emotion is terror, that emotion which is called up in the tale of The Hook and also in that hoary old classic, The Monkey's Paw. We actually see nothing outright nasty in either story. In one we have the hook, and in the other there is the paw, which, dried and mummified, can surely be no worse than those plastic dog turds on sale at any novelty shop. It's what the mind sees that makes these stories quintessential tales of terror.
It is the unpleasant speculation called to mind when the knocking on the door begins in the latter story and the grief-stricken old woman rushes to answer it. Nothing is there but the wind when she finally throws the door open. But what, the mind wonders, might have been there if her husband had been a little slower on the draw with that third wish. As a kid, I cut my teeth on William M. Gaines's horror comics, The Haunt of Fear, Tales from the Crypt, The Vault of Horror, plus all the Gaines imitators. But like a good Elvis record, the Gaines magazines were often imitated, never duplicated. Those horror comics of the 50s still sum up for me the epitome of horror, that emotion of fear that underlies terror, an emotion which is slightly less fine, because it is not entirely of the mind. Horror also invites a physical reaction by showing us something which is physically wrong. One typical EC screamer goes like this. The hero's wife and her boyfriend determine to do away with the hero so they can run away together and get married. In almost all the weird comics of the 50s, the women are seen as slightly overripe, enticingly fleshy and sexual, but ultimately evil. Castrating, murdering bitches who, like the trapdoor spider, feel an almost instinctual need to follow intercourse with cannibalism. These two heels, who might have stepped whole and breathing from a James M. Cain novel, take the poor slob of a husband for a ride, and the boyfriend puts a bullet between his eyes. They wire a cement block to the corpse's leg and toss him over a bridge into the river. 2 or 3 weeks later, our hero, a living corpse, emerges from the river, rotted and eaten by the fish. He shambles after wifey and her friend, and not to invite them back to his place for a few drinks either, one feels. One piece of dialogue from this story which I've never forgotten is, "I am coming, Marie, but I have to come slowly, because little pieces of me keep falling off." In The Monkey's Paw, the imagination alone is stimulated. The reader does the job on himself. In the horror comics, as well as the horror pulps of the years 1930 through 1955, the viscera are also engaged. As we have already pointed out, the old man in The Monkey's Paw is able to wish the dreadful apparition away before his frenzied wife can get the door open. In Tales from the Crypt, the thing from beyond the grave is still there when the door is thrown wide, big as life and twice as ugly. Terror is the sound of the old man's continuing pulse beat and the telltale heart, a quick sound, like a watch wrapped in cotton. Horror is the amorphous but very physical thing in Joseph Payne Brennan's wonderful novella, Slime, as it enfolds itself over the body of a screaming dog. No less a writer than Kate Wilhelm, the acclaimed mainstream and science fiction novelist, author of Where Late the Sweet Bird Sang and The Cluiston Test, among others, began her career with a short but gruesomely effective horror novel, a paperback original called The Clone, written in collaboration with Ted Thomas. In this story, an amorphous creature made of almost pure protein, more blob than clone, the science fiction encyclopedia rightly points out, forms in the sewer system of a major city, around a nucleus of half-rotted hamburger yet. It begins to grow, swallowing hundreds of people into its noxious self as it does. In one memorable scene, a little kid is yanked arm first into the drain of the kitchen sink. But there is a third level, that of revulsion. This seems to be where the chestburster from Alien fits. Better, let's take another example from the EC file as an example of the revolting story. Jack Davis's Foul Play from The Crypt of Terror will serve nicely, I think. And if you're sitting in your living room right now, putting away some chips and dip, or maybe some sliced pepperoni on crackers as you read this, maybe you just better put the munchies away for a while, because this one makes the chestburster from Alien look like a scene from The Sound of Music. You'll note that the story lacks any real logic, motivation, or character development, but, as in the tale of the hook, the story itself is little more than the means to an end, a way of getting to those last three panels. Foul Play is the story of Herbie Satin, pitcher for Bayville's minor league baseball team.
Herbie is the apotheosis of the EC villain. He's a totally black character with absolutely no redeeming qualities. The complete monster. He's murderous, conceited, egocentric, willing to go to any lengths to win. He brings out the mob man or mob woman in each of us. We would gladly see Herbie lynched from the nearest apple tree, and never mind the Civil Liberties Union. With his team leading by a single run in the top of the ninth, Herbie gets first base by deliberately allowing himself to be hit by an inside pitch. Although he is big and lumbering, he takes off for second on the very next pitch. Covering second is Central City's saintly slugger, Jerry Deegan. Deegan, we are told, is sure to win the game for the home team in the bottom of the ninth. The evil Herbie Satin slides into second with his spikes up, but saintly Jerry hangs in there and tags Satin out. Jerry is spiked, but his wounds are minor, or so they appear. In fact, Herbie has painted his spikes with a deadly fast-acting poison. In Central City's half of the ninth, Jerry comes to the plate with two out and a man in scoring position. It looks pretty good for the home team, guys. Unfortunately, Jerry drops dead at home plate even as the umpire calls strike three. Exit the malefic Herbie Satin, smirking. The Central City team doctor discovers that Jerry has been poisoned. One of the Central City players says grimly, "This is a job for the police." Another responds ominously, "No, wait. Let's take care of him ourselves. Our way." The team sends Herbie a letter, inviting him to the ballpark one night to be presented with a plaque honoring his achievements in baseball. Herbie, apparently as stupid as he is evil, falls for it, and in the next scene we see the Central City Nine on the field. The team doctor is tricked out in umpire's regalia. He is whisking off home plate, which happens to be a human heart. The base paths are intestines. The bases are chunks of the unfortunate Herbie Satin's body. In the penultimate panel, we see that the batter is standing in the box and that instead of a Louisville slugger, he is swinging one of Herbie's severed legs. The pitcher is holding a grotesquely mangled human head and preparing to throw it. The head, from which one eyeball dangles on its stalk, looks as though it's already been hit over the fence for a couple of home runs, although as Davis has drawn it, Jolly Jack Davis, as the fans of the day called him, he now sometimes does covers for TV Guide, one would not expect it to carry so far. It is, in the parlance of baseball players, a dead ball. The Crypt Keeper followed this helping of mayhem with his own conclusions, beginning with the immortal E.C. chuckle.
"Hee-hee! So that's my Yelp yarn for this issue, kiddies! Herbie the pitcher went to pieces that night and was taken out of existence, that is."
As you can see, both The Monkey's Paw and Foul Play are horror stories, but their mode of attack and their ultimate effect are light years apart. You may also have an idea why the comic publishers of America cleaned their own house in the early 50s, before the U.S. Senate decided to do it for them. So, terror on top, horror below it, and lowest of all, the gag reflex of revulsion. My own philosophy as a sometime writer of horror fiction is to recognize these distinctions because they are sometimes useful, but to avoid any preference for one over the other on the grounds that one effect is somehow better than another. The problem with definitions is that they have a way of turning into critical tools, and this sort of criticism, which I would call criticism by rote, seems to me needlessly restrictive and even dangerous. I recognize terror as the finest emotion, used to almost quintessential effect in Robert Wise's film The Haunting, where, as in The Monkey's Paw, we are never allowed to see what is behind the door. And so I will try to terrorize the reader. But if I find I cannot terrify him, her, I will try to horrify. And if I find I cannot horrify, I'll go for the gross out. I'm not proud. When I conceived of the vampire novel, which became Salem's Lot, I decided I wanted to try to use the book partially as a form of literary homage, as Peter Straub has done in Ghost Story,
working in the tradition of such classical ghost story writers as Henry James, M.R. James, and Nathaniel Hawthorne. So my novel bears an intentional similarity to Bram Stoker's Dracula, and after a while it began to seem to me what I was doing was playing an interesting, to me at least, game of literary racquetball. Salem's Lot itself was the ball, and Dracula was the wall I kept hitting it against, watching to see how and where it would bounce so I could hit it again. As a matter of fact, it took some pretty interesting bounces, and I ascribe this mostly to the fact that, while my ball existed in the 20th century, my wall was very much a product of the 19th. At the same time, because the vampire story was so much a staple of the EC Comics I grew up with, I decided that I would also try to bring in that aspect of the horror story. The scene in Salem's Lot, which works best in the EC tradition, at least as far as I'm concerned, is when the bus driver, Charlie Rhodes, who is a typical EC-type rotter in the best Herbie Satin tradition, awakes at midnight and hears someone blowing the horn of his bus. He discovers, after the bus doors have swung shut forever behind him, that his bus is loaded with children, as if for a school run. But they're all vampires. Charlie begins to scream, and perhaps the reader wonders why. After all, they only stopped by for a drink.
Hee hee.
Some of the scenes from Salem's Lot, which run parallel to scenes from Dracula, are the staking of Susan Norton, corresponding to the staking of Lucy Westenra in Stoker's book, the drinking of the vampire's blood by the priest, Father Callahan. In Dracula, it is Mina Murray Harker who is forced to take the Count's perverse communion as he croons those memorable, chilling lines, "My bountiful wine press for a little while." The burning of Callahan's hand as he tries to enter his church to receive absolution, when in Dracula, Van Helsing touches Mina's forehead with a piece of the host to cleanse her of the Count's unclean touch, it flashes into fire, leaving a terrible scar. And, of course, the band of fearless vampire hunters, which forms in each book. The scenes from Dracula, which I chose to retool for my own book, were the ones which impressed me the most deeply, the ones Stoker seems to have written at fever pitch. There are others, but the one bounce that never made it into the finished book was a play on Stoker's use of rats in Dracula. In Stoker's novel, the fearless vampire hunters, Van Helsing, Jonathan Harker, Dr. Seward, Lord Godalming, and Quincy Morris, enter the basement of Carfax, the Count's English house. The Count himself has long since split the scene, but he has left some of his traveling coffins, boxes full of his native earth, and another nasty surprise. Very shortly after the FVHs enter, the basement is crawling with rats. According to the lore, and in his long novel Stoker marshals a formidable amount of vampire lore, a vampire has the ability to command the lesser animals, cats, rats, weasels, and possibly Republicans. It is Dracula who has sent these rats to give our heroes a hard time. Lord Godalming is ready for this, however. He lets a couple of terriers out of a bag, and they make short work of the Count's rats. I decided I would let Barlow, my version of Count Dracula, also use the rats, and to that end I gave the town of Jerusalem's Lot an open dump, where there are lots of rats. I played on the presence of the rats there several times in the first couple of hundred pages of the novel, and to this day I sometimes get letters asking if I just forgot about the rats or tried to use them to create atmosphere or what. Actually, I used them to create a scene so revolting that my editor at Doubleday, the same Bill Thompson mentioned in the forenote to this volume, suggested strongly that I remove it and substitute something else. After some grousing, I complied with his wishes. In the Doubleday New American Library edition of Salem's Lot, Jimmy Cody, a local doctor, and Mark Petrie, the boy accompanying him, discover that the King Vampire, to use Van Helsing's pungent term, is almost certainly denning in the basement of a local boarding house. Jimmy begins to go downstairs, but the stairs have been cut away and the floor beneath littered with knives pounded through boards. Jimmy Cody dies impaled upon these knives in a scene of what I would call horror, as opposed to terror or revulsion. The scene is a middle of the roader. In the first draft manuscript, however, I had Jimmy go down the stairs and discover, too late, that Barlow had called all the rats from the dump to the cellar of Eva Miller's boarding house. There was a regular hojo for rats down there, and Jimmy Cody became the main course. They attacked Jimmy in their hundreds, and we are treated, if that is the word, to a picture of the good doctor struggling back up the stairs, covered with rats. They are down his shirt, crawling in his hair, biting his neck and arms. When he opens his mouth to yell Mark a warning, one of them runs into his mouth and lodges there, squirming. I was delighted with the scene as written because it gave me a chance to combine Dracula lore and EC lore into one. My editor felt that it was, to put it frankly, out to lunch, and I was eventually persuaded to see it his way. Perhaps he was even right. Rats are nasty little buggers, aren't they? I wrote and published a rat story called Graveyard Shift in Cavalier magazine 4 years prior to Salem's Lot. It was, in fact, the third short story I ever published, and I was uneasy about the similarity between the rats under the old mill in Graveyard Shift and those in the basement of the boarding house in Salem's Lot. As writers near the end of a book, I suspect that they cope with weariness in all sorts of ways, and my response as I neared the end of Salem's Lot was to indulge in this bit of self-plagiarism. And so, even though I suspect there's a disappointed rat fan or two out there, I've got to say I believe Bill Thompson's judgment that the rats in Salem's Lot should simply fade from the scene was the right one. I've tried here to delineate some of the differences between science fiction and horror, science fiction and fantasy, terror and horror, horror and revulsion, more by example than by definition. All of which is very well, but perhaps we ought to examine the emotion of horror a little more closely, not in terms of definition, but in terms of effect. What does horror do? Why do people want to be horrified? Why do they pay to be horrified? Why an Exorcist, a Jaws, an Alien? But before we talk about why people crave the effect, maybe we ought to spend a little time thinking about components. And if we do not choose to define horror itself, we can at least examine the elements and perhaps draw some conclusions from them. 2. Horror movies and horror novels have always been popular, but every 10 or 20 years they seem to enjoy a cycle of increased popularity and visibility. These periods almost always seem to coincide with periods of fairly serious economic and/or political strain. And the books and films seem to reflect those free-floating anxieties, for want of a better term, which accompany such serious but not mortal dislocations. They have done less well in periods when the American people have been faced with outright examples of horror in their own lives. Horror went through a boom period in the 1930s, when people hard-pressed by the Depression weren't ponying up at the box office to see 100 Busby Berkeley girls dancing to the tune of "We're in the Money." They were perhaps releasing their anxieties in another way, by watching Boris Karloff shamble across the moors in Frankenstein, or Bela Lugosi creep through the dark with his cape up over his mouth in Dracula. The 30s also marked the rise of the so-called shudder pulps, which encompassed everything from Weird Tales to Black Mask. We find few horror movies or novels of note in the 1940s, and the one great magazine of fantasy which debuted in that decade, Unknown, did not survive for long. The great Universal Studios monsters of the Depression days, Frankenstein's Monster, the Wolfman, the Mummy, and the Count, were dying in that particularly messy and embarrassing way that the movies seemed to reserve for the terminally ill. Instead of being retired with honors and decently interred in the moldy soil of their European churchyards, Hollywood decided to play them for laughs, squeezing every last quarter and dime admission possible out of the poor old things before letting them go. Hence, Abbott and Costello met the monsters, as did the Bowery Boys, not to mention those lovable-eye boinkers and headknockers, the Three Stooges. In the 40s, the monsters themselves became stooges. Years later, in another post-war period, Mel Brooks would give us his version of Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, Young Frankenstein, starring Gene Wilder and Marty Feldman instead of Bud Abbott and Lou Costello. The eclipse of horror in fiction that began in 1939 lasted for 25 years.
Oh, an occasional novel such as Richard Matheson's Shrinking Man or William Sloane's Edge of Running Water would pop up, reminding us that the genre was still there, although even Matheson's grim man against giant spider tale, a horror story if there ever was one, was touted as science fiction. But the idea of a best-selling horror novel would have been laughed out of court along Publisher's Row. As with the movies, the golden age of weird fiction had passed in the 30s when Weird Tales was at the peak of its influence and quality, not to mention its circulation, publishing the fiction of Clark Ashton Smith, the young Robert Bloch, Dr. David H. Keller, and, of course, the 20th century horror story's dark and baroque prince, H.P. Lovecraft. I will not offend those who have followed weird fiction over a span of 50 years by suggesting that horror disappeared in the 1940s. Indeed, it did not. Arkham House had then been founded by the late August Derleth, and Arkham published what I regard as its most important works in the period 1939 through 1960, works including Lovecraft's The Outsider and Beyond the Wall of Sleep, Henry S. Whitehead's Jumbie, The Opener of the Way, and Pleasant Dreams by Robert Bloch, and Ray Bradbury's Dark Carnival, a marvelous and terrifying collection of a darker world just beyond the threshold of this one. But Lovecraft was dead before Pearl Harbor. Bradbury would turn his hand more and more often to his own lyric blend of science fiction and fantasy, and it was only after he did so that his work began to be accepted by such mainstream magazines as Collier's and the Saturday Evening Post. Robert Bloch had begun to write his suspense stories, using what he had learned in his first two decades as a writer to create a powerful series of offbeat novels, which are only surpassed by the novels of Cornell Woolrich. During and after the war years, horror fiction was in decline. The age did not like it. It was a period of rapid scientific development and rationalism. They grow very well in a war atmosphere, thanks, and it became a period which is now thought of by fans and writers alike as the golden age of science fiction. While Weird Tales plugged grimly along, holding its own but hardly reaping millions, it would fold in the mid-50s after a downsizing from its original gaudy pulp size to a digest form failed to effect a cure for its ailing circulation. The SF market boomed, spawning a dozen well-remembered pulps and making names such as Heinlein, Asimov, Campbell, and Del Rey, if not household words, at least familiar and exciting to an ever-growing community of fans dedicated to the proposition of the rocket ship, the space station, and the ever-popular Death Ray. So horror languished in the dungeon until 1955 or so, rattling its chains once in a while but causing no great stir. It was around that time that two men named Samuel Z. Arkoff and James H. Nicholson stumbled downstairs and discovered a money machine rusting away unnoticed in that particular dungeon. Originally film distributors, Arkoff and Nicholson decided that since there was an acute shortage of B-pictures in the early 50s, they would make their own. Insiders predicted speedy economic ruin for the entrepreneurs. They were told they were setting to sea in a lead sailboat. This was the age of TV. The insiders had seen the future, and it belonged to Dagmar and Richard Diamond, private detective. The consensus among those who cared at all, and there weren't many, was that Arkoff and Nicholson would lose their shirts very quickly. But during the 25 years that the company they formed, American International Pictures, has been around, it's now Arkoff alone. James Nicholson died several years ago. It has been the only major American film company to show a consistent profit year in and year out. AIP has made a great variety of films, but all of them have taken dead aim on the youth market. The company's pictures include such dubious classics as Boxcar Bertha, Bloody Mama, Dragstrip Girl, The Trip, Dillinger, and the immortal Beach Blanket Bingo. But their greatest success was with horror films. What elements made these AIP films schlock classics? They were simple, shot in a hurry, and so amateurish that one can sometimes see the shadow of a boom mic in the shot or catch the gleam of an air tank inside the monster suit of an underwater creature, as in The Attack of the Giant Leeches.
Arkoff himself recalls that they rarely began with a completed script or even a coherent screen treatment. Often money was committed to projects on the basis of a title that sounded commercial, such as Terror from the Year 5000 or The Brain Eaters, something that would make an eye-catching poster. Whatever the elements were, they worked. 3. Well, let all that go for the moment. Let's talk monsters. Exactly what is a monster? Begin by assuming that the tale of horror, no matter how primitive, is allegorical by its very nature, that it is symbolic. Assume that it is talking to us, like a patient on a psychoanalyst's couch, about one thing while it means another. I'm not saying that horror is consciously allegorical or symbolic. That is to suggest an artfulness that few writers of horror fiction or directors of horror films aspire to. There has recently been a retrospective of AIP movies in New York, 1979, and the idea of a retrospective suggests art. But at most, they are trash art. The pictures have great nostalgia value, but those searching for culture may look elsewhere. To suggest that Roger Corman was unconsciously creating art while on a 4-day shooting schedule and a budget of $10,000 is to suggest the absurd. The element of allegory is there only because it is built in, a given, impossible to escape. Horror appeals to us because it says, in a symbolic way, things we would be afraid to say right out straight, with the bark still on. It offers us a chance to exercise, that's right, not exorcise, but exercise, emotions which society demands we keep closely in hand. The horror film is an invitation to indulge in deviant antisocial behavior by proxy, to commit gratuitous acts of violence, indulge our puerile dreams of power, to give in to our most craven fears. Perhaps more than anything else, the horror story or horror movie says it's okay to join the mob, to become the total tribal being, to destroy the outsider. It has never been done better or more literally than in Shirley Jackson's short story, The Lottery, where the entire concept of the outsider is symbolic, created by nothing more than a black circle colored on a slip of paper. But there is no symbolism in The Rain of Stones, which ends the story. The victim's own child pitches in as the mother dies, screaming, "It's not fair! It's not fair!" Nor is it an accident that the horror story ends so often with an O. Henry twist that leads straight down a mine shaft. When we turn to the creepy movie or the crawly book, we are not wearing our "everything works out for the best" hats. We're waiting to be told what we so often suspect, that everything is turning to shit. In most cases, the horror story provides ample proof that such is indeed the case. And I don't believe when Catherine Ross falls prey to the Stepford Men's Association at the conclusion of The Stepford Wives, or when the heroic black man is shot dead by the numbnuts sheriff's posse at the end of Night of the Living Dead, that anyone is really surprised. It is, as they say, a part of the game. And monstrosity? What about that part of the game? What sort of handle can we get on that? If we don't define, can we at least exemplify? Here is a fairly explosive package, my friends. What about the freaks in the circus? The carny aberrations observed by the light of naked 100-watt bulbs? What about Cheng and Ang, the famous Siamese twins? A majority of people considered them monstrous in their day, and an even greater number no doubt considered the fact that each had his own married life even more monstrous. America's most mordant and sometimes funniest cartoonist, a fellow named Rodriguez, has rung the changes on the Siamese twin theme in his Aesop Brothers strip in the National Lampoon, where we have our noses rubbed in almost every possible bizarre exigency of life among the mortally attached. The sex lives of, the bathroom functions of, the love lives, the sicknesses. Rodriguez provides everything you ever wondered about in regard to Siamese twins and fulfills your darkest surmises. To say that all of this is in poor taste may be true, but it's still a futile and impotent criticism. The old National Enquirer used to run pictures of car wreck victims and pieces,
and dogs munching happily away at severed human heads. But it did a land office business and grew before lapsing back into a quieter current of the American mainstream. And there is life in the old Inquirer yet. I buy it if there's a juicy UFO story or something about Bigfoot, but mostly I only scan it rapidly while in a slow supermarket checkout lane, looking for such endearing lapses of taste as the notorious autopsy photo of Lee Harvey Oswald, or their photo of Elvis Presley in his coffin. Still, it is a far cry from the old mom cooks pet dog and feeds it to the kids days. What about the other carny freaks? Are they classifiable as monstrosities? Dwarfs? Midgets? The bearded lady? The fat lady? The human skeleton? At one time or another, most of us have been there, standing on the beaten sawdust-strewn dirt, with a chili dog or a paper of sweet cotton candy in one hand, while the barker hucksters us, usually with one sample of these human offshoots standing nearby as a specimen, the fat lady in her pink little girl's tutu, the tattooed man with the tail of a dragon curled around his burly neck like a fabulous hangman's noose, or the man who eats nails and scrap metal and light bulbs. Perhaps not so many of us have surrendered to the urge to cough up the 2 bits or 4 bits or 6 bits to go inside and see them, plus such all-time favorites as the two-headed cow or the baby in a bottle. I've been writing horror stories since I was 8, but have never yet attended a freak show. But most of us have surely felt the impulse. And at some carnivals, the most terrible freak of all is kept out back, kept in darkness like some damned thing from Dante's ninth circle of hell, kept there because his performance was forbidden by law as long ago as 1910, kept in a pit and dressed in a rag. This is the geek, and for an extra buck or two, you could stand at the edge of his pit and watch him bite off the head of a live chicken and then swallow it, even as the decapitated bird fluttered in his hands. There is something so attractive about freaks, yet something so forbidden and appalling, that the one serious effort to use them as the mainspring of a horror picture resulted in the film's quick shelving. The picture was Freaks, a Todd Browning film made in 1932 for MGM. Freaks is the story of Cleopatra, the beautiful acrobat who marries a midget. In the best EC tradition, an EC that was almost 20 years unborn in 1932, she has a heart as black as midnight and a coal mine. It's not the midget she's interested in, it's his money. Like the mate-eating human trapdoor spiders of those comic book stories yet to come, Cleo soon takes up with another man. In this case, it's Hercules, the show's strongman. Like Cleopatra herself, Hercules is at least nominally okay, although it is with the freaks that our sympathies lie. These two heels begin a systematic poisoning program on Cleo's tiny husband. The other freaks discover what is going on and take an almost unspeakable revenge on the pair. Hercules is killed. There is a rumor that, as Browning originally conceived the film, the strongman was to be castrated. And the beautiful Cleopatra is turned into a bird woman, feathered and legless. Browning made the mistake of using real freaks in his film. We may only feel really comfortable with horror as long as we can see the zipper running up the monster's back, when we understand that we are not playing for keepsies. The climax of Freaks, as the living torso and the armless wonder and the Hilton sisters, Siamese twins, among others, slither and flop through the mud after the screaming Cleopatra, was simply too much. Even some of MGM's tame exhibitors flatly refused to show it, and Carlos Clarins reports in his illustrated history of the horror film, Capricorn Books, 1968, that at its one preview in San Diego, a woman ran screaming up the aisle. The film was exhibited, after a fashion, in a version so radically cut that one film critic complained that he had no idea what he was watching. Clarins further reports that the film was banned for 30 years in the UK, the country that has brought us, among other things, Johnny Rotten, Sid Vicious, the sniveling shits, and the charming custom of packy-bashing. Freaks is now sometimes exhibited on PTV stations, and may at this writing have finally become available on videocassettes. But to this day it remains a source of heated discussion, comment, and conjecture among horror fans, and although many have heard of it, surprisingly few have actually seen it. 4. Leaving freaks entirely out of it for the moment, what else do we consider horrible enough to label with what surely must be the world's oldest pejorative? Well, there are all those bizarre Dick Tracy villains, perhaps best epitomized by Flyface, and there was the archenemy of Don Winslow, the Scorpion, whose face was so horrible that he had to keep it constantly covered, although he would sometimes unveil it to minions who had failed him in some way. Said minions would immediately drop dead of heart attacks, literally scared to death. So far as I know, the horrible secret of the Scorpion's physiognomy was never uncovered. Pardon the pun. But the intrepid Commander Winslow did once succeed in unmasking the Scorpion's daughter, who had the slack, dead face of a corpse. This information was delivered to the breathless reader in italics. The slack, dead face of a corpse, for added emphasis. Perhaps the new generation of comic monsters is best epitomized by those created by Stan Lee's Marvel Comics, where for every superhero, such as Spider-Man or Captain America, there seem to be a dozen freakish aberrations. Dr. Octopus, known to children all over the comic-reading world as Doc Ock, whose arms have been augmented by what appear to be a waving forest of homicidal vacuum cleaner attachments. The Sandman, who is a sort of walking sand dune. The Vulture, Stegron. The Lizard. And, most ominous of all, Dr. Doom, whose appearance has been so badly maimed in his twisted pursuit of forbidden science that he now resembles a great clanking cyborg who wears a green cape, peers through eye-holes like the archer's slits in a medieval castle, and who appears to be literally sweating rivets. Superheroes with elements of monstrosity in their makeup seem less enduring. My own favorite, Plastic Man, always accompanied by his wonderfully screwball sidekick, Woozy Winks, just never made it. Reed Richards of the Fantastic Four is a Plastic Man look-alike, and his cohort, Ben Grimm, a.k.a. The Thing, looks like a hardened lava flow, but they are among the few exceptions to the rule. So far, we've talked about carny freaks and the caricatures we sometimes find in the funnies, but let's come a trifle closer to home. You might ask yourself what you consider monstrous or horrible in daily life. You're exempted from this if you're a doctor or a nurse. These people see all the aberrations they can handle. And much the same can be said for policemen and bartenders. But as for the rest of us, take fat. How fat does a person have to be before he or she passes over the line and into a perversion of the human form severe enough to be called monstrosity? Surely it is not the woman who shops Lane Bryant, or the fellow who buys his suits in that section of the menswear store reserved for the husky build. Or is it? Has the obese person reached the point of monstrosity when he or she can no longer go to the movies or to a concert because his/her buttocks will no longer fit between the fixed armrests of a single seat? You will understand that I am not talking about how fat is too fat here, either in the medical or aesthetic sense, nor anyone's right to be fat. I am not talking about the lady you glimpsed crossing a country road to get her mail on a summer day, her gigantic butt encased in black slacks, cheeks whacking and wobbling together, belly hanging out of an untucked white blouse like slack dough. I am talking of a point where simple overweight has passed through the outermost checkpoints of normality and has become something that, regardless of morality or immorality, attracts the helpless eye and overwhelms it. I am speculating on your reaction and my own to those human beings so enormous that we wonder about how they may perform acts that we mostly take for granted. Going through a door, sitting down in a car, calling home from a telephone booth, bending over to tie our shoes, taking a shower. You may say to me, "Steve, you're just talking carny again. The fat lady and her pink little girl's tutu. Those humongous twins who have been immortalized in the Guinness Book of World Records riding away from the camera that clicked the picture on identical tiny motor scooters, their buttocks sticking out to either side like a dream of gravity in suspension. But in point of fact, I am not talking about such people who, after all, exist in their own world where a different scale is applied to questions of normality. How freakish can you feel, even at 500 pounds, in the company of dwarfs, living torsos, and Siamese twins? Normality is a sociological concept. There's an old joke about two African leaders getting together with JFK for a state meeting, and then going home on a plane together. One of them marvels, "Kennedy, what a funny name!" In the same vein, there is the Twilight Zone episode, Eye of the Beholder, about the horribly ugly woman whose plastic surgery has failed for the umpteenth time, and we only find out at the end of the program that she exists in a future where most people look like grotesquely humanoid pigs. The ugly woman is, by our standards at least, extraordinarily beautiful. I am talking about the fat man or woman in our society, the 400-pound businessman, for example, who routinely buys two seats in tourist when he flies and kicks up the armrest between them. I am talking about the woman who cooks herself four hamburgers for lunch, eats them between eight slices of bread, has a quarter of potato salad on the side topped with sour cream, and follows this repast with half a gallon of Breyer's ice cream spread over the top of a table talk pie like frosting. On a business trip to New York in 1976, I observed a very fat man who had become trapped in a revolving door at the Doubleday Bookshop on Fifth Avenue. Gigantic and sweating in a blue pinstriped suit, he seemed to have been poured into his wedge of the door. The bookshop security guard was joined by a city policeman, and the two of them pushed and grunted until the door began to move again, jerk by jerk. At last, it moved enough to let the gentleman out. I wondered then, and wonder now, if the crowd that gathered to watch this salvage operation was much different from those crowds that form when the Kearney Barker begins his spiel, or when in the original Universal film Frankenstein's monster arose from its laboratory slab and walked. Are fat people monstrous? How about somebody with a hair lip or a large facial birthmark? You couldn't get into any self-respecting carny in the country with one of those two. Too common, so sorry. What about somebody with six fingers on one hand, or both hands, or a total of six toes on both feet? There are a lot of those guys around, too. Or, getting down even further toward your block, USA, what about someone with a really bad case of acne? Of course, ordinary pimples are no big deal. Even the prettiest cheerleader on the squad is apt to get one on her forehead or near one corner of her kissable mouth once in a while. But ordinary fat is no big deal either. I'm talking about the case of acne that has run absolutely apeshit, spreading like something out of a Japanese horror movie, pimple on pimples, and most of them red and suppurating. Like the chest burster in Alien, it's enough to put you off your popcorn. Except this is real. Perhaps I've not touched your idea of monstrosity in real life even yet, and perhaps I won't, but for just a moment, consider such an ordinary thing as left-handedness. Of course, the discrimination against left-handed people is obvious from the start. If you've attended a college or a high school with the more modern desks, you know that most of them are built for inhabitants of an exclusively right-handed world. More educational facilities will order a few left-handed desks as a token gesture, but that's all. And during testing or composition situations, lefties are usually segregated on one side of the lecture hall so they will not jog the elbows of their more normal counterparts. But it goes deeper than discrimination. The roots of discrimination spread wide, but the roots of monstrosity spread both wide and deep. Left-handed baseball players are all considered screwballs, whether they are or not. Take, for instance, Bill Lee, late of the Montreal Expos and the Boston Red Sox. Lee was dubbed the Spaceman by his colleagues and is remembered fondly by Boston fans for exhorting those who attended a rally following the Sox's pennant win in 1975 to pick up their trash when they left. Perhaps the strongest proof of his leftiness came when he referred to Red Sox manager Don Zimmer as the designated gerbil. Lee moved to Montreal soon after. The French for left, bastardized from the Latin, is la sinistre, from which comes our word, sinister. According to the old superstition, your right side belongs to God, your left side to that other fellow. Southpaws have always been suspect. My mother was a lefty, and as a schoolgirl, so she told my brother and me, the teacher would wrap her left hand smartly with a ruler to make her change her pen to her right hand. When the teacher left, she would switch the pen back again, of course, because with her right hand she could make only large, childish scrawls. The fate of most of us when we try to write with what New Englanders call the dumb hand. A few of us, such as Branwell Bronte, the gifted brother of Charlotte and Emily, can write clearly and well with either hand. Branwell Bronte was, in fact, so ambidextrous that he could write two different letters to two different people at the same time. We might reasonably wonder if such an ability qualifies as monstrosity or genius. In fact, almost every physical and mental human aberration has been at some point in history, or is now, considered monstrous. A complete list would include widow's peaks, once considered a reliable sign that a man was a sorcerer, moles on the female body, supposed to be witches' teats, and extreme schizophrenia, which on occasion has caused the afflicted to be canonized by one church or another. Monstrosity fascinates us because it appeals to the conservative Republican in a three-piece suit who resides within all of us. We love and need the concept of monstrosity because it is a reaffirmation of the order we all crave as human beings. And let me further suggest that it is not the physical or mental aberration in itself which horrifies us, but rather the lack of order which these aberrations seem to imply. The late John Wyndham, perhaps the best writer of science fiction that England has ever produced, summarized the idea in his novel, The Chrysalids, published as Rebirth in America. It is a story that considers the ideas of mutation and deviation more brilliantly than any other novel written in English since World War II, I think. A series of plaques in the home of the novel's young protagonist offer stern counsel. Only the image of God is man. Keep pure the stock of the Lord. In purity our salvation. Blessed is the norm. And most telling of all, watch thou for the mutant. After all, when we discuss monstrosity, we are expressing our faith and belief in the norm and watching for the mutant. The writer of horror fiction is neither more nor less than an agent of the status quo. 5. Having said all that, let's now return to the American international pictures of the 1950s. In a little while, we'll talk about the allegorical qualities of these films. You there in the back row, stop laughing or leave the room. But for now, let's stick to the idea of monstrosity. And if we touch allegory at all, we'll touch it only lightly, by suggesting some of the things films were not. Although they came along at the same time rock and roll broke the race barrier, and although they appealed to the same fledgling boppers, it's interesting to notice the sort of things that are altogether absent, at least in terms of real monstrosity. We've noted already that the AIP pictures and those of the other independent film companies that began to imitate AIP gave the movie industry a much-needed shot in the arm during the ho-hum 50s. They gave millions of young viewers something they couldn't get at home on TV, and it gave them a place where they could go and make out in relative comfort. And it was the indies, as Variety calls them, that gave a whole generation of war babies an insatiable jones for the movies, and perhaps prepared the way for the success of such disparate movies as Easy Rider, Jaws, Rocky, The Godfather, and The Exorcist. But where are the monsters? Oh, we've got fake ones by the score. Saucer men, giant leeches, werewolves, mole people, in a Universal picture, and dozens more. But what AIP didn't show as they tested these interesting new waters was anything that smacked of real horror. At least as those war babies understood the term emotionally. That is an important qualification, and I hope you'll come to agree with me that it warrants its italics. These were, we were, children who knew about the psychic distress that came with the bomb, but who had never known any real physical want or deprivation. None of the kids who went to these movies were starving or dying of internal parasites. A few had lost fathers or uncles in the war. Not many. And in the movies themselves, there were no fat kids, no kids with warts or ticks, no kids with pimples, no kids picking their noses and then wiping it on the sun visors of their hot rods, no kids with sexual problems, no kids with any visible physical deformity, not even such a minor one as vision that had been corrected by glasses. All the kids in the AIP horror and beach pictures had 20/20 vision. There might be an endearingly wacky teenager on view, of the sort often played by Nick Adams, a kid who was a bit shorter or did daring kooky things, such as wearing his hat backwards like a baseball catcher, and who had a name like Weirdo or Scooter or Crazy, but that was as far as it ever went. The setting for most of these films was small-town America, the scene the audience could best identify with. But all of these our towns looked eerily as if a eugenics squad had gone by the day before production actually began, removing everyone with a lisp, a birthmark, limp, or potbelly. Everyone, in short, who did not look like Frankie Avalon, Annette Funicello, Robert Young, or Jane Wyatt. Of course, Elijah Cook Jr., who appeared in a great many of these films, has always looked a bit weird, but he always got killed in the first reel, so I feel he really doesn't count. Although both rock and roll and the new youth movies, everything from I Was a Teenage Werewolf to Rebel Without a Cause, burst upon an older generation just beginning to relax enough to translate their war into myth, with all the unpleasant surprise of a mugger leaping out of a privet hedge, both the music and the movies were only pre-shocks of a genuine youth quake to come. Little Richard was certainly unsettling, and Michael Landon, who didn't even have enough school spirit to at least take off his high school jacket before turning into a man-wolf, was also unsettling. But it would still be miles and years to the fish cheer at Woodstock and old Leatherface doing impromptu surgery with his McCulloch in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It was a decade when every parent trembled at the specter of juvenile delinquency, the mythic teenaged hood leaning in the doorway of the candy store there in our town, his hair bejeweled with Vitalis or Brill Cream, a pack of Luckies tucked under the epaulette of his motorcycle jacket, a fresh zit at one corner of his mouth, and a brand new switchblade in his back pocket, waiting for a kid to beat up, a parent to harass and embarrass, a girl to assault, or possibly a dog to rape and then kill, or maybe vice versa. It is a once-dread image, which has James Dean and or Vic Morrow here, wait 20 years, and hey presto, out pops Arthur Fonzarelli. But during the period, the newspapers and magazines of the popular press saw young JDs everywhere, just as these same organs of the Fourth Estate had seen commies everywhere a few years before. Their chain-decked engineer boots and pegged Levi's could be seen, or imagined, on the streets of Oakdale and Pineview and Centerville, in Mundamian, Iowa, and in Lewiston, Maine. The shadow of the dreaded J.D. stretched along. Marlon Brando had been first to give this empty-headed nihilist a voice in a picture called The Wild One. "What are you rebelling against?" the pretty girl asks him. Answers Marlon, "What have you got?" To some fellow in Asher Heights, North Carolina, who had somehow survived 41 missions over Germany in the belly of a bomber, and who now only wanted to sell a lot of Buicks with power flight transmissions, that sounded like very bad news indeed. Here was a fellow for whom the JCs held no charms. But as there turned out to be fewer communists and fifth columnists than was at first suspected, the shadow of the dread JD also proved to be rather overrated. In the last analysis, the war babies wanted what their parents wanted. They wanted driver's licenses, jobs in the cities and homes in the suburbs, wives and husbands, insurance, underarm protection, kids, time payments which they would meet, clean streets, clear consciences. They wanted to be good. Years and miles between Senior Glee Club and the SLA, years and miles between our town and the Mekong Delta, and the only known fuzz-tone guitar track in existence was a technical mistake on a Marty Robbins country and western record. They adhered happily to school dress codes. Long sideburns were laughed at in most quarters, and a guy wearing stacked heels or bikini briefs would have been hounded unmercifully as a faggot. Eddie Cochran could sing about those crazy pink-pegged slacks, and kids would buy the records, but not the pants themselves. For the war babies, the norm was blessed. They wanted to be good. They watched for the mutant. Only one aberration per picture was allowed in the early youth cult horror film of the 50s, one mutation. It was the parents who would never believe. It was the kids who wanted to be good who stood watch, most often from those lonely bluffs which overlook our town from the ends of Lover's Lanes. It was the kids who stamped the mutant out, once more making the world safe for country club dances and Hamilton Beach blenders. Horrors in the 50s for the war babies were mostly, except maybe for the psychic strain of waiting for the bomb to fall, mundane horrors. And perhaps a conception of real horror is impossible for people whose bellies are full. The horrors the war babies felt were scale model horrors. And in that light, the movies that really caused AIP to take off, I Was a Teenage Werewolf and I Was a Teenage Frankenstein, become mildly interesting. In Werewolf, Michael Landon plays an attractive but moody high school student with a quick temper. He's basically a good kid, but he's involved in one fight after another. Like David Banner, the Hulk's alter ego on TV, the Landon character actually provokes none of these fights, until it looks as though he will be suspended from school. He goes to see a psychiatrist, Whit Bissell, who also plays the mad descendant of Victor Frankenstein in Teenage Frankenstein, who turns out to be totally evil. Seeing Landon as a throwback to an earlier stage of human development, like back to the alley-oop stage, Bissell uses hypnosis to regress Landon totally, in effect, deliberately making the problem worse instead of trying to cure it. Bissell's experiments succeed beyond his wildest dreams, or worst nightmares, and Landon becomes a ravening werewolf. For a 1957 high school or junior high school kid watching the transformation for the first time, this was bad shit. Landon becomes the fascinating embodiment of everything you're not supposed to do if you want to be good. If you want to get along in school, join the National Honor Society, get your letter, and be accepted by a good college where you can join a frat and drink beer like your old man did. Landon grows hair all over his face, produces long fangs, and begins to drool a substance that looks suspiciously like Burma shave. He peeks at a girl doing exercises on the balance beam all by herself in the gymnasium, and one imagines him smelling like a Randy Polecat who just rolled in a nice fresh pile of coyote shit. No button-down Ivy League shirt with a Fruit Loop on the back here. Here's a fellow who doesn't give a fart in a high wind for the scholastic aptitude tests. He has gone absolutely not ape shit, but wolf shit. Undoubtedly, part of the reason for the movie's meteoric takeoff at the box office had to do with the liberating vicarious feelings the movie allowed these war babies who wanted to be good. When Landon attacks the pretty gymnast in the leotard, he is making a social statement on behalf of those watching, but those watching also react in horror, because on the psychological level, the picture is a series of object lessons on how to get along, everything from shave before you go to school to never exercise in a deserted gym. After all, there are beasts everywhere. 6. If I Was a Teenage Werewolf is psychologically that old dream of having your pants fall down when you stand up during homeroom period to salute the flag, taken to its most nightmarish extreme, the ultimate hirsute outsider menacing the peer groups at our town high, then I Was a Teenage Frankenstein is a sick parable of total glandular breakdown. It is a movie for every 15-year-old who ever stood in front of her or his mirror in the morning looking nervously at the fresh pimple that surfaced in the night and realizing glumly that even Stridex-medicated pads weren't going to solve the whole problem no matter what Dick Clark said. I keep coming back to pimples, you may say. You are right. In many ways, I see the horror films of the late 50s and early 60s, up until Psycho, let us say, as paeans to the congested pore. I've suggested that it may be impossible for a people whose bellies are full to feel real horror. Similarly, Americans have had to severely limit their conceptions of physical deformity, and that is why the pimple has played such an important part in the developing psyche of the American teenager. Of course, there's probably a guy out there, a guy born with a congenital birth defect, who's muttering to himself, "Don't talk to me about deformity, you asshole." And it is certainly true that there are Americans with club feet, Americans without noses, amputee Americans, blind Americans. I've always wondered if the blind of America felt discriminated against by that McDonald's jingle that goes, "Keep your eyes on your fries." Besides such cataclysmic physical fuck-ups of God, man, and nature, a few pimples look about as serious as a hangnail. But I should also point out that in America, cataclysmic physical fuck-ups are, so far at least, the exception rather than the rule. Walk down any ordinary street in America and count the serious physical defects you see. If you can walk 3 miles and come up with more than half a dozen, you're beating the average by a good country mile. Look for people under 40 whose teeth have rotted right down to the gum line, children with the bloated bellies of oncoming starvation, folks with smallpox scars, and you will look in vain. You'll not find folks in the A&P with running sores on their faces or untreated ulcers on their arms and legs. If you set up a head inspection station at the corner of Broad and Main, you could check 100 heads and come up with only 4 or 5 really lively colonies of head lice. Incidents of these and other ailments rise in white rural areas and in the inner cities, but in the towns and suburbs of America, most people are looking good. The proliferation of self-help courses, the growing cult of personal development, "I'm going to be more assertive, if that's all right with you," as Irma Bombeck says, and the increasingly widespread hobby of navel contemplation, are all signs that, for the time being, great numbers of Americans have taken care of the nitty-gritty realities of life as it is for most of the world, the survival trip. I can't imagine anyone with a severe nutritional deficiency caring much about "I'm okay, you're okay," or anyone trying to scratch out a subsistence-level existence for himself, his wife, and his 8 kids, giving much of a toot about Werner Erhard's Est course or Rolfing. Such things are for rich folks. Recently, Joan Didion wrote a book about her own odyssey through the 60s, The White Album. For rich folks, I suppose it's a pretty interesting book, the story of a wealthy white woman who could afford to have her nervous breakdown in Hawaii, the 70s equivalent of worrying over pimples. When the horizons of human experience shrink to HO scale, perspective changes. For the war babies, secure except for the bomb, in a world of 6-month checkups, penicillin, and eternal orthodontics, the pimple became the primary physical deformity with which you were seen on the street or in the halls of your school. Most of the other deformities had been taken care of. And, say, having mentioned orthodontics, I'll add that many kids who had to wear braces during those years of heavy, almost suffocating peer pressure saw them as a kind of deformity. Every now and then you would hear the cry of, "Hey, metal mouth!" in the halls. But most people saw them only as a form of treatment, no more remarkable than a girl with her arm in a sling or a football player wearing an ace bandage on his knee. But for the pimple, there was no cure. And here comes I Was a Teenage Frankenstein. In this film, Whit Bissell assembles the creature played by Gary Conway from the bodies of dead hot rodders. The leftover pieces are fed to the alligators under the house. Of course, we have an idea early on that Bissell himself will end up being munched by the gators, and we are not disappointed. Bissell is a total fiend in this movie, reaching existential heights of villainy. "He's crying. Even the tear ducts work. You've got a civil tongue in your head. I know you have, because I sewed it back myself." Quoted in An Illustrated History of the Horror Film by Carlos Clarence, New York, Capricorn Books, 1968. But it is the unfortunate Conway who catches the eye and mainsprings the film. Like the villainy of Bissell, the physical deformity of Conway is so awful it becomes almost absurd, and he looks like nothing so much as a high school kid whose acne has run totally wild. His face is a lumpy bas-relief map of mountainous terrain from which one shattered eye bugs madly. And yet, And yet, somehow, this shambling creature still manages to dig rock and roll, so he can't be all bad, can he? We have met the monster, and, as Peter Straw points out in Ghost Story, he is us. We'll have more to say about monstrosity as we go along, and hopefully something of a more profound nature than is contained in the ore we can mine from I Was a Teenage Werewolf and I Was a Teenage Frankenstein, but I think it's important first to establish the fact that, even on their simplest level, these tales of the hook do a number of things without even trying to. Allegory and catharsis are both provided, but only because the creator of horror fiction is above all else an agent of the norm. This is true of horror's more physical side, and we'll find it's also true of works which are more consciously artistic, although when we turn our discussion to the mythic qualities of horror and terror, we may find some rather more disturbing and puzzling associations. But to reach that point, we need to turn our discussion away from film, at least for a while, and to three novels which form most of the base on which the modern horror genre stands. Chapter 3. Tales of the Tarot. One of the most common themes in fantastic literature is that of immortality. The thing that would not die has been a staple of the field from Beowulf to Poe's tales of Monsieur Valdemar and of the Telltale Heart to the works of Lovecraft, such as Cool Air, Blatty, and even, God save us, John Saul. The three novels I want to discuss in this chapter seem to have actually achieved that immortality, and I believe it's impossible to discuss horror in the years 1950 through 1980 with any real fullness of understanding unless we begin with these three books. All three live a kind of half-life outside the bright circle of English literature's acknowledged classics, and perhaps with good reason. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde was written at white heat by Robert Louis Stevenson in 3 days. It so horrified his wife that Stevenson burned the manuscript in his fireplace, and then wrote it again from scratch in another 3 days. Dracula is a frankly palpitating melodrama couched in the frame of the epistolary novel, a convention that had been breathing its last gasps 20 years before when Wilkie Collins was writing the last of his great mystery suspense novels. Frankenstein, the most notorious of the three, was penned by a 19-year-old girl, and although it is the best written of the three, it is the least read, and its author would never again write so quickly, so well, so successfully, or so audaciously. In the most unkind of critical lights, all three can be seen as no more than popular novels of their day, with little to distinguish them from novels roughly similar, The Monk by M.G. Lewis, for instance, or Collins's Armadale, books largely forgotten except by teachers of Gothic fiction who occasionally pass them on to students who approach them wary.